that gavel was
called this meeting to order so we can have time for everybody who wants to speak to be able to speak. We have to be fair as we can be. And we don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start out with House File 1032. Representative Torkelson, will you introduce your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1032 deals with an employment issue regarding hours of work before overtime, commonly called 410s, that would allow employers to use their 40 hours in 410-hour days instead of 5 8-hour days. This is a bill that has already passed through two committees. In the interest of time, I won't speak long. I understand we want to get through this bill quickly this morning because there's a more controversial bill coming. So with that, I would ask someone in the committee to move my bill.
I will move House File 1032 to pass and go to Ways and Means. And go ahead.
You have a list of testifiers.
We have a list of testifiers. We'll start out with Dean Stetsch, S-T-I-S-H. Sorry if I wreck your name. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Deanne Stish, and I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. As many of you know, that this issue is prevalent for highway contractors, we wanted to raise the issue that this also affects the clean and drinking water projects that are under the jurisdiction of Public Facilities Authority. That's nearly $500 million in projects a year in the public works arena that would be affected by this issue. As many of you know, when clean drinking water projects are done around the state, it requires digging trenches, and the importance of handling these projects quickly and getting through them as many as possible throughout the year is just a priority. From an environmental standpoint, once we open these holes up, if there is a weather incident, we need to now deal with that weather incident and dewater, handle erosion issues before we ever get back to the scope of the project. So it's incredibly important once we're out there, we can get to that project for as long as possible. That's where the 10-hour day comes into play, where we can get out there, get set up, and spend as many hours as possible on the project. From a purely functional standpoint, we used to have a comfort zone of bidding projects within a circle from the place of origin. Now we're all over the state. So when our crews are traveling or staying in hotels, they're there through the week. If a rain event happens, it's idle time. It's time and cost wasted. As soon as it rains, my phone lights up, not only from companies but contractors themselves, wondering why they're only getting 32 hours this week. And you know, the question is whether or not there was money in the budget for this intermittent, unpredicted overtime. We know that the federal standard, Davis-Bacon, is 40 hours. We know private work standard is 40 hours, and many of the labor contracts themselves have 40-hour standards in them. We're simply looking for the committee, Mr. Chairman, to consider making the statute for prevailing wage covering highway and heavy projects to join that 40-hour standard. So this is an opportunity to present efficiency. It'll also allow us to do more projects through the year. As it comes to the end of the season, we can't start certain projects and leave them halfway completed. So we're stopping projects earlier. Typically, layoffs might happen in November. Now we're seeing layoffs as early as August. So if we're able to condense the time on these projects, we're able to do more projects, we're able to sustain employment longer before we lay folks off for the year. So with that, I'll just stay brief, and if there's any questions, I'd happily take them, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your brevity. We have a quorum now, so officially call this meeting to order. And while we're waiting for that, we'll have Mark Stellan come to the testifying table next, and we plan on getting done with this bill in 20 minutes. So please, brevity is important, and the next bill will have a half hour for both sides and then questions, and then we'll have a vote on it. Please give your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mark Saline, president of Saline Brothers Incorporated, a highway and underground contractor in Holly, Minnesota, which is up by Detroit Lakes in Morehead area on Highway 10. We are a union contractor signatory to the Local 49. We strongly support HF 1032 because of the benefits to our employees and to the communities that we work in. For example, if we had a project in Alexandria, Minnesota, which is 100 miles from our shop, and we scheduled the project for a 48-hour work week, 40 hours of straight time, 8 hours of overtime, under current prevailing wage law, we would have to work 4 10-hour days and 1 8-hour day for a 5-day work week. Under HF 1032, we would be able to work 4 12-hour days against 40 hours of straight time, 8 hours of overtime, but we'd also free up that Friday. If our workload doesn't permit, we would allow our employees to have a 3-day weekend and we start all over the following week. We also run into the holiday deal this year. July 4th is on a Monday. We can't work on July 4th, so the work week under current prevailing wage law would be slid back one day, 4 10s and an 8, Tuesday through Saturday. Under HF 1032, we would be able to work Tuesday through Friday, 4 12s, again, no impact to overtime, 40 hours of straight, 8 hours of overtime. The benefits would be one less day on the road for our employees and anybody associated with that project. The impact to the communities that we work on would be significant because Alexandria or any towns in the state of Minnesota that are resort towns, if we got to disrupt traffic in the community on a weekend in the summer, it's not fun. So HF 1032 will allow us to compress the work week into 4 days. It would not, and the biggest benefit, it will not affect the overtime of our employees. So that's about it. And if there's any questions, feel free to ask me.
Okay, doesn't appear to be any questions. We'll take questions at the end also. Next, Julie Methowich. Welcome to our committee. Give you a name for the record.
Thank you. Actually, my name is Julie Anderson. I am Vice President of Mathewitz Construction. I apologize for the error there. I am one of the owners of Mathewitz Construction Company. We are a heavy highway road contractor located in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. And our employees and Mathewitz Construction are very supportive of the 410s. One of the main issues that we see with this is the quality of life that it will bring to our employees. Many weeks of the year, our employees get the one of their regular 8-hour days essentially pushed into the Saturday, as Mr. Saleen had mentioned. And our employees' family events, such as reunions or whatever, we realize in Minnesota that the summertime weekends are extremely booked, and employees do like to plan things for their weekends. And unfortunately, if we have something such as a utility hit or a rain delay or anything like that, we almost have to tell our employees, assume that Saturday is going to be a work day in any week where we have an interruption. And the main reason behind that is because, you know, we do, right now, we are limited to having 8 of each day of the straight time, and the last day is overtime. So in each case, these 8-hour days get pushed to Saturdays and recreation plans. It would be less travel, as Mr. Saleen had also said, for the lodging for our employees, as they do travel to the sites, and typically they stay there overnight for our people because our radius is large. So we need to be able to tell them before Friday night if they're going to be staying Friday night, and so we try to communicate that early. If we had the 410s, there would be much more potential for giving the Saturday off. And the other thing that we experience at Mathewitz Construction is our contracting agencies, the cities, the counties, MnDOT officials, and local units of government. Many of them for years have already been on 410s, so even the project oversight people tend to not want to be there on the days past 410s. And so when we do have to push into Saturdays and things like that, oversight on the projects becomes a bit of a challenge as well. So we, as Mathewitz Construction, are very supportive of the 410s initiative. And at this point, that's all I have to say. So if any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Gunter. Good to see you back.
Thank you.
Does Mathewitz Construction, do your employees on Friday nights, I'm interested in this, the contractors in my area that have to have Friday nights and their employees have to stay out, let's say they're doing a project on the North Shore or somewhere like that in the district that I represent, they find out that they have to pay a lot more for housing on those nights because it's
weekends. Definitely can end up being premium pay on the hotel stay, definitely. If you're in like the Benji or the Brainerd area, the races are there and there are other people buying for those same hotel spaces. So the employee cost to stay does go up.
I'd like for the committee to take good note of that because okay. I've had a fair amount of complaints.
Members, I think we're going to hear both sides first and then we'll have questions for both to be the fairest we can be. So now we'll have Harry Melander come to the testifying table.
No.
You're not Harry Melander.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. We kind of reversed the order of our testimony. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney. I'm a legislative director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. I'm testifying today for Dan McConnell with Local 292 Minneapolis, who wasn't able to be here. Now, the IBEW Minnesota State Council has 13 local unions representing over 15,000 workers across the state. About 60% of them, roughly 9,000 members, are members that can potentially be working on prevailing wage projects. Excuse me. The IBEW is opposed to this bill. Now, while there's a growing move towards a 10-hour day in some industries, we're concerned about the effect that this will have on the safety of our members working on highway heavy projects. They're working outside on roads, bridges, airports, power plants, and other utility projects. And electricity is nothing to fool around with. But ask yourself to put yourselves in their shoes and consider how fatigue will affect the men and women who work in this physically demanding environment, often in hot and humid, sticky conditions, near high-speed traffic, and with other hazards. 2 hours additional work on a day doesn't seem like a lot, but after 8 hours in the hot sun or other inclement weather, you're having sweat run down your forehead into your eyes, your pores, and 2 more hours of getting sand and dirt blown in your face, it can have an effect. We're also concerned about the effect on members' families. Now, while the idea of having a three-day weekend is great, it doesn't really work out that way. We need to remember that when you add the possibility of disruption of the work week due to unique Minnesota weather conditions, you have the very real possibility under this bill that you'll see a Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday work week. How do you plan for a weekend with your family around that? You don't. Under current industry practice and due to our limited construction season, many employers schedule long work days. However, the current law gives employees the flexibility to decide if they want to work the overtime on that particular day or not, depending on how they feel, if they're tired, if they're not feeling well, or if they have family obligations that they need to attend to. They have that option. Under this proposal, that same employee would need permission from the employer to leave the job early, and such repeated requests could impact their ability to retain employment, forcing them to choose between their job and their family or health. Now, several studies done by the CDC have shown that a 13% increase in injuries occur by increasing the work hours from 8 hours to 10 hours. That results in higher worker compensation costs. Additionally, multiple studies have reported that between the 9th and 12th hours of work, there's an increased problem with feelings of decreased alertness, increased fatigue, lower cognitive function, declines in vigilance on task members, and increased injuries. In closing, I'd like to give you some historical perspective on the creation of the 8-hour day. You may or may not be aware that one of the biggest factors in the creation of the 8-hour day standard was Henry Ford. On January 5th, 1914, the Ford Motor Company took the radical step of doubling pay of its workers to $5 a day, and they cut shifts from 9 hours to 8 hours. The moves were not very popular with their competitors, but it did result in Ford seeing an increase in productivity and a significant increase in profits from $30 million to $60 million in just 2 years. Well, the competitors followed suit shortly thereafter. But because of these reasons, and because we feel that this bill leaves open the possibility of abuse and a negative effect on the safety of our members, we ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Harry Melander. Are you going to Ed next? Edmund Oso. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and just on a personal note, welcome back.
Thank you.
As I said, my name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and I'm here to offer opposition to House File 1032. Now, you hear some of these companies, and I know in the last committees they had said that workers want this. Workers are asking for this. I've not heard one worker testify in favor of this bill. The biggest misconception is, Mr. Chair and committee members, they can do this now. There is no law that prohibits them from doing this as I speak. What they are after is cutting their overhead. They are after cutting the overhead of paying overtime. We currently have members, and many members in the highway and heavy industry. What happens, they work 4/10, but they get paid 8 hours of overtime. This is a win-win situation for both the employer and the employees. The employees get one day off, and they get overtime for it. The trade-off to the employer is that they don't have to open for that fifth day. They can do this now. Now, in the event of rainy days, as was stated before, last week, they would have only worked 2 days. In the event that they worked 10-hour days, they would have lost 4 hours of overtime. This is the thing that bugs me and our members the most. This targets just one trade, highway and heavy. That one craft of drivers and some of the other crafts that fall in place. And there's no rhyme or reason to it. I know you know, there was somebody up here that just testified on behalf of one of their company and stated that they need it because it's not like all the other industries. But yet, they want to treat highway and heavy completely different than all the other crafts. Why not have some reasoning to it? There is none. Why not just make it, I don't want to sound ridiculous, but how about everybody with a size 9 shoe or green hair or blue eyes? There's no rhyme or reason why just pull highway and heavy out and treat them differently than everybody else. Now, this bill will affect both union and non-union workers alike. We are here to speak out in favor and ask for support to help them. Now, this will also affect the industry because it will drive down wages. And right now in this industry, when it has been faced with one of the most devastating times in the history of building trades, in the history of construction, when workers are finally starting to get back to work, this would cut their pay. There's a ton of workers back here. Are you voting for this and in that vote saying that these workers don't work hard enough when it's 20 degrees outside and they have water up to their waist in a ditch, that when they work 8 hours, they don't deserve a premium pay after 8 hours because they've not worked hard enough? That's wrong. We ask that you join us in opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, Harry Melander. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, and we're supposed to be done in about 2 minutes ago?
I will be brief, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm employed by the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here today to ask that you say no to a bill that does nothing but cut wages for Minnesota workers. Mr. Chairman, you've heard this argument before, that Minnesota will save money by eliminating overtime after 10 and our next bill, 40 hours a week. Mr. Chairman, committee members, there's no guarantee that these savings will be passed on to Minnesota taxpayers. The only guarantee is that workers, those sitting out in the crowd here, will work for less. Mr. Chairman, there is no data that provides any substantial information that says that this bill will do anything for Minnesota workers other than cut their wages, but what we believe, it will increase profits for our contracting partners. If we take a pay cut, we're just wondering if those contractors that stand here today will also reduce their profits. I don't believe so. We've talked that maybe there should be an amendment to that this bill that actually caps the profit on state jobs, let's say by 1.5% to 2%. Mr. Chairman, we don't want that, nor do the individuals that employ our members want that. Mr. Chairman, we want our employers, our partners in this industry, to be successful. When they do better, we do better. Sir, on the idea that this bill accurately reflects what happens in the industry, I will call it somewhat of a half-truth. The highway-heavy industry are very, very different industries. Roads, state systems, waste treatment plants, power and generating systems, dams and airports. I can assure you that these industries are not based on a 10-hour workday. These testifiers here today work for us on many issues together during this session. They are our partners. But this issue does nothing but raise management's profits and cut, as one of our contractors said in last week's testimony, the juice out of our tank. Mr. Chair, this bill is not good for your constituents, my neighbors, my family. Do what's right for Minnesota. Park this bill and let's have some real conversations that put Minnesota's back to work, not cuts their wages. Thank you for your time, and I believe you deserve every cent that you make. Keep up your work and watch out for Minnesota. They expect that out of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Pete Parrish. Pete Parrish there?
He's way in the back.
Way in the back, okay.
He's coming around.
Come around the bend. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Pete Parrish. I'm the political director for the Sheet Metal Workers Local Number 10. A little surprised I didn't think I was speaking today, but I will anyways. I have to agree with so much of what's already been said. And looking back at my life as working in the construction trade, starting at, let's say, 6 o'clock in the morning, you get up between 4:30 and 4:45 every morning. You go to work. By the time you get off work, it's going to be 4:30. By the time you get home, it's going to be 5:30. That gives you enough time to maybe have get the supper going with you and your wife if she's working, then to get the kids out to go see a baseball game, softball game that they're in. Now all of a sudden you're starting to cut in that time. By the time you get home, it's 8 o'clock at night. Time you get everything going, get the kids to bed. Now all of a sudden now your day is 10 o'clock and then you start all over again. Everybody that's in this room that's sitting around here, you all started in January. You've put in very long days. Imagine doing this for 30 years, never having a break. You guys are supposed to be done in the middle of May. This, for a construction worker, would go on day after day after day and that, and then talking about the 10-hour days and with the makeup day. You get up in the morning, if it's not raining, you go onto the job site, and all of a sudden it starts to downpour. Well, you go home. You don't get paid for that day, I agree. Now you have a makeup day. Do you have? What do you do when you go home that day? You're not going to be doing much, if anything, because you weren't planning to be off on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or something like that. So now, or that Saturday where you were planning to go up to the cabin, or that Friday, which you're thinking you're going to have off, you're not going to have off now with no compensation. That's why you have the time and a half for those days, is just so you can enjoy it a little bit to be compensated for the weekend. That's why we have the overtime.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Now, members, we have questions for anyone that testified. Boy, we have a lot of knowledgeable people here. Seeing no questions, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, it seems how we have a full house here. It would seem to me that this is a bill that's got a little bit of a concern by an industry. So I'm going to ask for a roll call on it. I think this bill has been around an awful lot. I don't have a lot of questions. Actually, I don't have any questions. But I will tell you, this is a personal story. I haven't really tried to bring personal stories into legislative hearings, but this is what I do. I get stuck working 410s on a regular basis. And then asked on a rain day to come in because come in on a Friday because of a rain day. And I don't work on a lot of prevailing wage jobs for a variety of reasons, but this is my experience. I am up at 4:30. I'm on the job site at 6:30 at the very latest to have the toolbox open by 7. And I don't know who's getting off at 4:30 on a 10-hour day. I don't get off till 5:30. And after 8 hours standing in the heat, typically as a pipe fitter, it's kind of warm where we work, so that the comments about the sweat only gets amplified. Those last 2 hours are a tough, tough 2 hours. And the original intent of time and a half was to punish for poor planning. It wasn't meant as a reward. It wasn't meant as anything other than to make businesses or the customer realize that they have to allow enough time for that particular job to get done. And when I get off at 4:30, I don't get home because it's a 45-minute commute, typically, to 6:15. I don't have much left, much energy left after working 10 hours in 90-degree heat, 80-degree heat with 30, 40, 60% humidity. Typically, I love to barbecue in the summer. My wife tends to do it on those kind of days because I just don't have the energy. And I have to get, typically, have to be in bed, sleeping by 9 o'clock. If I remember my children right, they were barely in bed by 9 o'clock. Never did get them trained that way. So a 10-hour day sounds good on paper, but if you're actually out there pulling on a pipe wrench or loading a shovel of dirt, it's hard. And it is really, that last 2 hours is blood money, as we like to call it. It's my contention, and I hope I can bring some people along with this, is that the poor planning on the part of the contractor or the customer is not my fault, and I should be rewarded for giving them the extra 2 hours. The other thing you have to realize is that on a 410 day, you can't say, no, I only want to work 8. When they're asking me to work a 10 hours with 2 hours of time and a half, by law, they can't require me to work that extra 2 hours. I can go home and keep my job. But if we pass this bill along, they can fire you for not working those last 2 hours. And I'll just end with this. Many of the fellows I work with live up in the north end of Chisago County. It's an hour and 20-minute commute each way. So they're not getting home till 6:30, 7 o'clock. Members, I would hope that we would not pass this out, this committee. I hope we can defeat this in this particular committee. It does help businesses, but it certainly hurts the workers and takes money out of their pocket.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess we have a few time constraints.
Representative Mulry.
I'm sorry. What?
If you could keep it short, we do have a few time constraints. We have another bill after this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Be pretty short.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that, and I never worked with contractors on highway heavy, but smaller contractors on other prevailing wage jobs, that was all built in. Mr. Melander suggested that if we were going to head this way, then we should cap the profits because they'll still be built in and probably just making more profits.
You will. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will try to be brief, but this is a very important issue. This is even an issue that should, and I'm going to stand down for a while, should go to capital investment. This bill in particular will affect any bonding projects on roads and bridges. Could even create more accidents by having people work longer, get more tired, knowing they're not going to be paid overtime. But I guess I have, a question for the author. A couple questions. Representative Torkelson, do you think the people that work on our highways and our roads and stuff are good people?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative House, for that question. Of course, I know they're good people because I know many of them.
Do you think the...
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. The general contractors that hire them and put them to work and bid on projects, and think they're pretty good people?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative House. The ones I know are great people.
Mr. House. Mr. Chairman, then I need to know why, as a Republican, someone who espouses a belief in private enterprise and in people solving their own problems and working out agreements, why don't you leave this to the negotiating table? Why are you bringing government in to the private sector, telling people how to negotiate and what they can negotiate for?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Representative Howes. I believe this actually simplifies the process and brings it into closer match with other existing provisions in both federal and private practice.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, making the speed limit 35 miles an hour on every highway and road would be simple. I'm extremely disappointed if this moves out of this committee, and if it looks like there's hope in ways and means, which I really don't believe there is, then I will do a motion on the floor to send it to capital investment. I'll ask for a roll call vote. But what I'm going to ask the members to do here today is realize that they have an election certificate. They have the right to vote their conscience, the people of their district, the people that sent them here, not what any group of people or leadership people tell them they should vote. They have a right to vote their conscience, and I would applaud anyone that has the courage to vote their conscience, and I will vote my conscience today, and that's a no.
Any other questions? Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to the testifier, I'm just curious, I think it was Representative Mahoney who maybe asked about, you know, if you refused, this would prevent someone who wanted to only work eight, they would potentially risk being fired. I mean, obviously, I have to believe that that wouldn't be your intention of this legislation to, you know, make people who wanted to work eight get fired if they didn't. Was there ever any discussion about certain employees or maybe having a discussion about that where some could work eight but without changing the overtime requirements?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question. As a farmer, I the weather is my boss, and I work well beyond the 10-hour day whenever I need to. So my understanding of these requirements is limited. If one of the testifiers would care to answer your question, I'd appreciate it, because my guys that work on the farm work as long as they need to, and I'm not subject to these sorts of 8-hour limitations or 10-hour limitations as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Melander comes to answer the question.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'll attempt to answer that. I don't believe that most of the contractors in this room would fire a man or a woman if, in fact, they refused to work more than their a standard 8-hour shift, but I can assure you that being in this industry since 1973, as Mr. Mahoney, there is always that threat. We are in this industry because we're productive. We make our contractors money. When our contractors tell us to work longer days, no one's going to tell you that they're going to fire you if in fact, but there's always that thought and that cloud that hangs over individuals' heads. It's somewhat of an unwritten rule. If your superintendent to your foreman tells you you're going to work 12s, you work 12s.
Okay. I have one question. Is anything in this bill make it mandatory that someone has to work 10 hours or 8 hours, or it's all a matter of overtime after 40? Mr. Melander.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I believe that this bill makes reference to overtime after 10, and the bill that we'll hear in the future or next is overtime after 40.
Okay. Thank you. With that, seeing no other questions, roll call has been requested. Representative Torkelson renews his, I renew the motion to have House File 1032 passed and sent to Ways and Means. Go ahead.
Representative Gunther?
Yes.
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Dill?
No.
Representative Howes?
No.
Representative Kiefer?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Lemire?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Yes.
Representative Moline?
No.
Representative Mullery?
Nope.
Representative Murray?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Stensrud?
Yes.
Representative Swedzinski?
Yes.
On a vote from of 9 yeses and 8 nays, bill passes and goes on to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to add my congratulations on your return to the committee.
Thank you. Next, we have House File 1476. Welcome to the committee. Would you give you can give your name for the record. We all like to hear it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peggy Scott, and I'm here to present House File 1476, if someone would be willing to move that on the committee.
Members, I will move House File 1476 to pass and go to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what we hope to accomplish with this bill is to put more people back to work and get them off the bench by making our state construction dollars stretch further, because we would be able to do more projects. This should come as a welcome news to many workers who have been out of work for months or for maybe even a year, more than a year. In Minnesota and most other states and our nation, we are being forced to look at doing more with less. The state demographer has said that unless we change the way we do government and make structural changes, we will continue to experience budget deficits as far as the eye can see. We need to get the most out of every dollar spent in the state of Minnesota, and this bill will help accomplish that. I just want to let you know that this morning we have met with representatives from the union, and we want to continue on with those talks and as well as they do. Just want to sketch out the two different areas of this bill. The first part of House File 1476 deals with prevailing hours of labor. Currently, overtime is triggered, as we talked with the about in the previous bill presentation. It's triggered at both 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week. Many workers are asking for a more flexible schedule, such as the 410s that we just talked about, and many companies are more than happy to allow for this flexibility. However, this does require that they pay 8 hours of overtime a week. This bill would still allow for overtime for hours past 40-hour mark, but the overtime trigger after 8 hours worked in a given day would no longer apply. According to the Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Report in 2007 on page 43, you'll see that this would allow the Department of Labor and Industry to set prevailing hours that reflect practices in the construction industry. And it was actually one of their recommendations. Part two of the bill deals with the method to determine prevailing wage. Let me first say that this bill does not do away with prevailing wage. Every year, contractors can report the wages and benefits paid to their workers on a job class basis to the Department of Labor and Industry. According to a study done by the Office of the Legislative Auditor's Report, page 26, only an estimated 25 to 38% of all construction projects were reported to the Department of Labor to set this standard. Currently, the prevailing wage is calculated using the mode of all wages and benefits reported to the Department of Labor in a given year. For instance, in Sherburne County, the wages reported to the Department of Industry's annual survey may be something like this for Metalcaster: $18 an hour, $25 an hour, 20, 21, 22, 25, 19, and 22. 25 is the mode because it is the rate most often paid. When more than one mode exists for a job class in a particular geographic area, the highest mode prevails. This bill changes the calculation method to mean or average. By using the mean calculation, smaller contractors who currently do not participate in a very high percentage in the wage survey will be more likely to submit wages using the department's survey tool. Once again, I want to reiterate that this bill seeks to get more workers off the bench by making the state dollars go further. And with that, I would open up to the testifiers.
Very well. And Bill Frank is the first testifier. Would you please come up and give your testimony? We would appreciate brevity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Frank, and I'm the general manager of Steve Yagi Specialized Truck Service, located in Rochester, Minnesota. Yagi is a member of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 1476. By way of background, our company has been in business since 1994, and our fleet has grown from one truck and one owner to 35 trucks. We specialize in particular areas of the trucking industry, one of which is road construction. I am here today in support of this bill. Yagi and its drivers help to build roads, so we deal with Minnesota's prevailing wage laws on a regular basis. We believe that the language before you represents a positive change to the current system. In our opinion, moving from the mode to the mean would give an employer like us the ability to put more people onto state road projects, and as a result, help the state with the ability to increase the size and scope of those projects. As we all know, our state's infrastructure is in dire need of maintenance and repair. However, evidence shows that the estimated need far outpaces our ability to actually fund all of those projects. Putting this situation into the context of prevailing wage, we often ask ourselves, with a more realistic wage rate, how many more miles of road could Yagi help build? And while we don't know the exact answer to that question, I believe there's an argument to be made that with this proposal, state government would get more bang for the buck. Additionally, Yagi has a vested interest in stretching the highway trust fund dollars, as we pay thousands of dollars annually in fuel tax and license fees to build, repair, and maintain the very roads that we help build. In fact, without adequately maintained roads and bridges, Yagi's business can be compromised. Let me give you a real-life example. During the road construction season last year that stretched from approximately May 1st through the end of October, we had one specialized piece of equipment that was dedicated to a local contractor and driven by the same driver. As a result, we have detailed statistics for that truck. During the 7 months our truck was operated, we accumulated roughly 725 hours of prevailing wage work. While working on a prevailing wage job, we were required to pay the driver more than 1.5 times the amount their regular wage. Now, that's not time and a half we're talking about. That is a little over 150% more than the non-prevailing wage rate. As a result, that single Yagi driver and truck performed work for the state at a net loss. This begs the question, why would Yagi want to work its trucks on prevailing wage jobs in the future? We use the same truck and the same driver on the prevailing wage jobs as the non-prevailing wage jobs for this contractor. So there was no loss in quality of labor or equipment. Let me repeat that. We use the same truck and the same driver on the prevailing wage jobs as the non-prevailing wage jobs for that contractor. If quality were an issue, would the contractor have used us on the prevailing wage jobs? Yet the state of Minnesota paid additional money to just one truck dedicated to just one contractor for one season. If it weren't for Yagi bearing some of that cost itself, the state would have paid the full amount. Don't you just wonder how much additional cost was borne by the state during the entire construction season last year? Members of the committee, I don't know exactly how much it costs to pave a mile of roadway. But I do know, based on our example of just one truck, it is more than the state of Minnesota needs to pay or can afford to pay with our existing prevailing wage law. In conclusion, I would encourage you to support this bill. Changing the department's calculation method from mode to mean would not only result in more realistic reflection of wage rates throughout the state, but also help Minnesota stretch its scarce financial resources further in an area where it's desperately needed. This concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tom Hesse. Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1476, which makes two changes, as you've heard, to the Minnesota prevailing wage law. And also, just to shorten the time of testimony, I also want to mention that the NFIB Minnesota also supports this legislation, although they won't be up here speaking today. The first change, as we've talked about, is a modification to the trigger of overtime. As you know, it currently triggers either if you work over 8 hours per day or over 40 hours per week. And as also has been noted, the legislative auditor report found that this limitation prevents the Department of Labor and Industry from setting prevailing hours according to the practices in the construction industry. The second change is the calculation method used to determine the prevailing wage. Minnesota, California, Hawaii, Indiana, and Missouri are the only states that use the simple mode calculation for prevailing wage, according to the legislative auditor report. The federal government and 15 other states use a mode in some context, but often if there's not either a majority wage rate or sometimes a wage rate that represents 30% in common, the average is used. So I think by passing this legislation, we're moving closer to what a variety of other states use by using the average. Just want to mention one other point that was highlighted in the last testimony, and that's the savings that could be generated by this change. And by savings, if you look at the amount of a construction season, to me, savings means you have more money to generate, or as the previous testimony said, to pave more miles of road, to build more projects, so you can plow the given capital budget you have into more projects and have more workers performing them. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll close just by urging you to support the bill, correct the, at least what we think is a flaw in Minnesota's prevailing wage calculation and overtime requirement, and bring them closer to the norms of other states and the industry in general. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Phil Raines, next to testify.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members.
Welcome.
Phil Raines from Associated Builders and Contractors. You should have a handout in your packet. I'm not going to walk through everything in here in the interest of time. But if you look at it real quick for the slide that says Wabasha County Carpenters, you're going to see how the rate was actually calculated. This isn't a hypothetical situation. This is a real situation, how this was calculated. If you notice, none of the numbers match there. Each rate submitted was a different number. So they used the highest number, saying it at $39, $31 an hour for carpenters in Wabasha County. We compared that against actual data of average pay out there. The gold standard of data is the occupational employment statistics from DEED. They require 75% reporting on that data before they use it. It's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics nationally uses to tell you what area rates are. If you look at that, it would be $21.41 an hour. And that data is not perfect. It doesn't include fringe benefits. If you use a standard calculation, which is about 23% of the basic wage, that would put it up to what the mean would be there at $25.63 an hour. By using the mean in this situation, you would have gotten an accurate representation of what area rates are. If you go to the next slide, Kennebec County. There you have a situation where you had a few duplicates in there. You had three at $46.29, two at $23.30, two at $19.76. Since there were three, the most frequently occurring, it was set at $46.29 an hour. If you use the mean of that, you would have gotten $28.24 an hour. Let's compare it against what we know to be the real wages being paid in that area, $20.25 an hour. Add on your 23% on there, you're right about in the exact range that it should be at. Then if you flip to the third slide, I want to emphasize, we're looking for an accurate representation of the wages paid in the area. This is a great example of a low wage. Not always are these wages high, though most frequently they are. Sometimes they're actually low. Most frequently occurring number, $9.50 an hour. If you look at, again, the gold standard of statistics, $14.11 an hour. Nobles County, economically depressed area, that's a very low wage, and but for that area, that's what you pay. If you take the mean there, it would be $15.43 an hour. That might be actually a little bit low after 23% added on top, but again, it would be much closer to what average rates are. I want to make two emphases here. One is, this is a minimum wage. The prevailing wage is not the wage we're dictating to people to pay. This is a minimum wage law for construction only. We're the only industry out there that the government actually does this on. And when you set a minimum wage, you don't go looking for the highest wage around. You go looking for an average wage. You look for what's typical, what an average worker in the area would get. A minimum should actually be lower than the average, but it's a minimum wage. At least you should set it an average, not look for the highest rate. That's exactly what our wage law does right now, looking for the highest wage. It does set some artificially low wages. The mode is a very, very terrible way to go out and try to look for average wages. If you ask any statistician out there, they'll tell you it has no central tendency. It's very subject to the whims of the data that's collected. I also want to emphasize, If you're under a collective bargaining agreement or you have a wage higher than this, this is not going to lower your wage one penny. If you're a $50 an hour construction worker, you're highly trained, a really good worker out there, you have nothing to worry about this. I'm sorry, it's very true. You have nothing to worry about this. If you provide productivity justifying that $50 an hour, you can compete against any worker in the world. Representative Mahoney, I know, is a pipe trades worker, works in private work. If you're on private work, you have none of this wage guarantee except for the federal and state minimum wage law, which is far lower than anybody in construction gets. The question is, does the state want to look for the average and set that as a wage out there, or does the state want to look for the highest wage possible and set that as the minimum? Because that's basically how the law works right now. Also, this also applies to the 8-hour work rule. If you don't have the 8-hour work rule in place, this doesn't say that they have to pay, you have to work 10 hours a day. That's going to be up to your collectively bargained agreement or up to what you've worked out with your employer. Some employers require 8-hour work days. Some employers work more than that. Again, this is a very rare instance where the government actually steps in and does that. In just about every instance in the public and private sector, there's a requirement that you pay 40 at overtime after 40 hours a week. We're just asking for similar treatment for public construction in Minnesota. We had a very strong bill. Representative Leidiger was I'm very happy he carried that for us. Would have fixed a lot of the problems that are out there. I looked at the history of this of prevailing wage. Every instance of legislation in Minnesota affecting prevailing wage has been something to strengthen, make it, you know, increase fines, increase penalties, increase reporting requirements on prevailing wage. We've lost the balance on this. The bill in front of you is a very moderate bill, and I very much encourage you, please, let's just bring things back to normal. And this is a rare instance. Everybody's looking for ways in this budget times to do more with less. This is one instance where it's plainly true we can do more with less. We'll get 7.5 to 10% more roads out there. You'll get 7.5 to 10% more construction, more people off the bench by employing people through this new calculation.
Thank you. Next, we have former Representative Ray Cox. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Cox. I've been operating a general building company for about 39 years, and I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 1476 that's before you. I'm not here to talk about the merits. We're hearing an awful lot of information about prevailing wages, and I suspect there's a lot of people in the room that would like them applied to every working job, and there's a lot of people in the room that would think that the government should just stay out of this and not get involved with setting rates. But we have them here, and I think this is a common sense bill that can modify them. As long as we are using prevailing wages, I think it makes sense to use an average rather than the mode. I'm not going to go over the information Mr. Raines just went over with you, but you can see how the mode is set, and it in fact does grab the high, tends to grab the high hourly rates. And the other thing that it does while it's doing that, it can tend to drive up public projects. And at this day and age, I don't think anybody should really be looking to drive public work projects and make them more expensive. I think we can stretch our dollars more by implementing this bill. In previous times, I served for about 16 years on the Northfield School Board, and I don't know if any of you, yes, some of you were in the legislature. As I look around, when there was a time when prevailing wages regulations were modified and applied to school projects, whether or not they can contain state funding. And Northfield schools were caught in that. At the time, we had a small project, about a $4 million project, go out, and we had to include prevailing wages during the project while it was being built. The law was contested and it was thrown out. And we were given, quote, damages by the state to the tune of, I don't remember exactly, somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000 to our little district because we had to include prevailing wages. Well, if it's adding costs like that on little projects like that, I think you really need to look at how you're setting these rates. Another issue that hasn't been brought up is because there are not always accurate reporting information from either the counties, our 87 counties, or the regions that are being used. The prevailing wage regulations go one or two counties over and can grab information. That can really skew things. It doesn't sound like much, but going from one county to another county a couple of ways really can change the labor rates in an area. I'd rather see us use more accurate information, which I think averages are, but I'd also encourage you to look at using information that the state already collects. And Mr. Raines referred to some of that and so forth. That's not a time for that today, but think about that. And then finally, I'd just like to remind you that artificially setting wage rates and establishing what they are really doesn't necessarily translate to more workers. I've heard a lot of people in this session talking about jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, a higher rate for somebody does not necessarily mean you're creating more jobs. And in fact, it can have an opposite effect because as wages are pushed higher in this, employers will look around after they have a job and see, okay, how can I do this? How can I do this without having to experience as much cost on the job? There's ways that's been done in the trucking industry by there's ways you've seen in the auto industry, implementation of robotic welders, robotic plasma cutters, lifting and shaping devices of all sorts. They take the place of people. And I think we need to be careful with that. The last part of the bill, the overtime after 40, I really call this the family-friendly modification. I don't know what else to call it. When you have the ability to work longer than 8 hours, some people will want to take advantage of that. I know my employees have asked many times about doing that, and they want to go to a kindergarten Christmas pageant, school conferences, you know, whatever it is. And if you can have some flexibility in the schedule and allow them to do that, you'll do it. If you, as Mr. Mahoney or Representative Mahoney pointed out, if the employer is penalized for having overtime work, you're not going to do that because the margins on public projects are too tight today. Another gentleman said that maybe we should cap profits at 1% or 2%. I'd love to have projects that made 1% or 2%. It's just about impossible on some of the things today. So picking up a bunch of overtime isn't going to work in there as an option. I'd rather let the employees and employers work together on that. So in closing, I'll just ask you to please support House File 1476, and it was good to see you all here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Kurt Sapanik, welcome to our committee.
Thank you for letting me speak. I'll basically be quick because I know we're running over. My name is Kurt Sapaniak with Horizon Roofing. We're a commercial roofing company in Minnesota. Basically, one of our biggest things that we're looking at for with the 40-hour work week is our industry, just like road work, landscaping, anything that deals with outside weather gets affected heavily when we get rain days. This spring is a good example of that, where in our industry, anything over 30% chance of rain when we're re-roofing a building, we can't tear off the building because, of course, nobody wants a flooded building. So if we get several days worth of rain, and under the current rules, if we're only able to work 8 hours that day, these guys may get, you know, 16, 24 hours that week. Like the previous person was talking, there's no room to be working overtime. Also, too, when we have, you know, like the first bill they were talking about, if they have a hole open or something, they may have to get that closed up so that doesn't affect any stormwater issues. So what we've been asked for by our crews many times is if they're working, if they miss a couple days, can they work longer days, which we're not allowed
we don't allow them to because of overtime on prevailing wages. We've also been asked by crews that are working on the road if maybe they can work 4 days instead of 5 days so then they can be back over the weekend. I've also heard people talk about if we do this, the additional profits are never going to get passed back to the state. It's going to be the owners that are going to take and keep this, feed it to their bottom line. With the current, with the way things are being bid nowadays, if there's any way that we can lower our costs, we're going to lower our costs to get projects because that's how we keep people working, period. With our company, we'd only do about $2 million a year in prevailing wages, but when I calculated if we had guys on the road one less day, so maybe they work four tens or something like that, when you cut out the supervision, gas, wear and tear on vehicles, overhead, basically everything that goes into this, our company would be able to cut about or save about $130,000 a year to taxpayers. With us only doing about $2 million a year, I estimate how many projects the state does per year. I'm thinking that's probably around $130 million. So then my question is could we then be helping out, to build more projects or to be funding the nonprofits that have been cut dramatically over this time period? That I'll conclude that quickly because thank you very much.
Thank you. Mark Meyer.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Mark Meyer. I'm here to support House File 1476. I'm a shareholder and controller for Breitbach Construction Company. We're a general building contractor located in El Rosa, Minnesota. I believe the current mode method of calculating the prevailing wage does not fairly represent the actual wages paid in construction work in Minnesota. As you know, about 75% of all contractors pay their employees based on experience and productivity, and the current method, if you have just two cement masons, say making $40 an hour in a certain county, and those get reported, that, and you have 50 other cement masons that make, say, between $20 and $25 or $20 and $30 an hour in that same county, just that, as long as none of those other 50 are reported at the exact same rate, just those two will set the rate for that county. So you have a very small percentage of workers that are setting the rate for an entire county. I think it when you get that type of disparity, it just seems to be obvious that you're not getting an average of what's representative of the industry. So when we bid work in outstate Minnesota, cement mason rates are frequently in the $35 to $40 range. In the past 9 months, we bid three projects, one in Brainerd, Wadena, and one in Rochester. And the cement mason rates on those projects were $38.65 an hour, $39.45, and $39.26. And as Phil had mentioned earlier, the deed rates average closer to $25 an hour. So you're looking at an increase of $10 to $15 per hour compared to that $25. So it's anywhere from a 30, 40 to 50% increase over actual wages being paid. I know one of the items that's frequently brought up is why more merit shop contractors don't report wages on the surveys that are collected each year. And I think the reason is because of the mode. You have to report the exact same dollar amount for multiple employees to have an effect on the ultimate wage scale. And again, because we compensate our employees based on experience and productivity, we generally don't have multiple employees earning the exact same rate.
I know that.
I know another item that's frequently brought up is that higher wages improve quality. But yet, the 2007 Office of Legislative Auditor report on prevailing wages on page 84 states that there has been little or no comprehensive research on the issue of whether prevailing wage laws have resulted in better quality construction. And another item that's been brought up is that if the mean or average method is used, that contractors will line their pockets and have larger profits. Margins on public work, not right now, are less than 2%. It's so competitive out there. If you're the low bidder on a public project, you go back and you check your bid 2-3 times to make sure that you don't have a mistake, because there just isn't any margin there to be able to have mistakes. So the competitive pressure that's out there is going to keep anyone from taking a lower wage and using that to increase their markup. There just isn't room to do that. So in summary, I ask that you support House File 1476. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Kent Schwickard. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman. Committee, can you hear me okay?
Fine.
My name is Kent Schwickert, and I am the Vice President of Schwickert's, a Tech America company. Schwickert's is a third-generation company that was founded in 1906, and our company has offices in Mankato and Rochester, Minnesota. Schwickert's supports this bill, and we appreciate and hope that you will support it as well. Our primary construction activities are mechanical and roofing construction, and our employees are represented by both union and non-union, depending on respective trades. Over the past 25 years, we have seen the prevailing wage that represents many construction trades classifications to become less representative of actual wages that are paid in respective counties. In fact, in some Minnesota counties, we believe the prevailing wage is 50% higher than the actual wages paid in local companies performing the same work. This opinion is trade specific, but it reinforces the need to identify flaws in the current method of calculation. We believe this representation is driven by the method for which the prevailing wage is determined. The fact that the method of calculation is based on the mode and not the average highly skews the results and prevents a proper representation of what exists in the marketplace. We believe if the calculation is derived by the mean average, like all surrounding states around Minnesota, and similar to the federal government method of calculation, we would have more realistic understanding of wages paid for in the construction services of our state. A change in the method of calculation will allow the cost of construction projects in many counties to reduce, saving the state of Minnesota and its residents the cost of construction services purchased. We are also requesting your support for the rule change that allows for overtime after worked in a work week versus the current requirement for 8 hours in a given day. Currently, the rule requires the worker to be limited to 8 hours of work per day before overtime rules apply in the prevailing wage projects. In today's marketplace, most union agreements have changed to allow for the 40-hour work rule because of demands in the marketplace. Requiring workers to be limited to 8 hours of work drives higher costs, many times extends construction schedules. For our roofing operations, 8-hour workdays limits our productivity. Increases in our overall costs by increasing travel and subsistence, and often prevents flexibility when schedules are challenged by weather or forces beyond our control. In closing, with today's economic environment, the business community has required to make many difficult decisions and analyze its costs. In turn, we feel our legislative leaders need to identify ways to reduce its costs and be more responsible for our taxpayers' dollars recognizing when change is required. We support it, and we hope that you will, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Tom Revenue? Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is actually John Olson. I am an attorney in Mr. Revenue's firm. I am an attorney with the firm of Seaton, Peters, and Revenue. Our firm, and my practice in particular, involves representing employers. In particular, we represent many, many construction industry employers. In the course of that representation, I have reviewed innumerable employee compensation packages as well as union collective bargaining agreements for my clients. We're talking about both union contractors as well as merit shop contractors. In the course of reviewing those policies, my observation and my experience is that among merit shop contractors, overtime that is paid over 8 hours a day is almost non-existent on private sector work. That is important when you consider that, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only about 13% of the construction industry in this country is unionized. 87% of the construction industry is merit shop, and that 87% pays overtime based on over 40 a week, not over 8 hours a day. Now, on that basis alone, there is almost no way that overtime being paid over 8 hours a day can be considered a prevailing condition of employment. But in addition to that, even in the unionized sector of the construction industry, we are seeing more and more often that the collective bargaining agreements do not require overtime over 8. They require overtime over 40. And in the context particularly of public projects and highway heavy projects, in particular the agreement with the operating engineers Local 49 for highway heavy work and the laborers union for highway heavy work, both of these collective bargaining agreements negotiated between the unions and the between the unions and AGC, both require overtime over 40, not over 8. Based on these facts, it is simply my observation, and what I would urge you to consider is that as far as the overtime part of this bill goes, overtime over 8 cannot be considered a prevailing condition of employment in Minnesota. That prevailing condition is overtime over 40, and this bill would simply change the law to recognize the reality of that fact. Thank you.
Thank you. And next to testify, Carrie Melander.
Mr. Chairman, before I move, I know earlier in your opening statements that you said you would allow each of us equal time. My math says that the supporters of the bill were here for roughly 50 minutes. I believe that the committee goes till 2:30.
We'll go until you get your 50 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, sir. In our lineup, sir, it will be a bit different than the folks that are supporting this bill. I will have myself, we'll give a brief comment, I'll read a letter from one of our contractors. We will have a Dr. Jordan come up and address the group specifically talking about the mode. We will have an individual that works out in the field and then one of our contractor association members. So with that, what I'd like to do is first to pass this out to folks. Thank you. I'd like to read this letter, Mr. Chairman. This individual is unable to attend today because of a commitment. Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to express the opposition of our company to House File 1476, a bill that would negatively impact the construction industry in Minnesota by lowering prevailing wages. I run the Twin City office for Lunda Construction Company. Lunda, founded in 1938, currently employs 320 construction workers in our Twin City office who perform over $150 million of MnDOT work in 2010. I firmly believe that if passed, House File 1476 would have a detrimental impact on our company, our employees, and the heavy industry in general. The current prevailing wage system is currently efficient and works very well. Our company negotiates its wages with construction workers in the private sector, and the prevailing wage accurately reflects that reality. The wages paid to Lunda employees ensure that our company has the best trained, most highly productive workforce possible. These highly trained employees provide the traveling public in Minnesota with some of the highest quality construction roads and bridges in the Midwest. In 2010, MnDOT projects came in $67 million, or 9% under budget. Our company completes our projects using local workers, and we believe we provide a great value to Minnesota taxpayers. Lowering the prevailing wages will not save taxpayers money. It will, however, increase the likelihood that companies like ours will lose more bids to companies that have less qualified and skilled workers who lack the ability to provide a quality product to the state of Minnesota and who likely import lower wage labor and take our tax dollars out of state. I encourage you not to pass House File 1476. Please don't hesitate to contact me for additional information. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I had somewhat of a prepared statement today, but because of what I've just observed, I'm just going to make a couple of comments. I'm not sure if any of you know what a monkey grinder is. A monkey grinder was an individual who back in the day would take your attention away from you and pick your pockets. That's what I believe we've just heard. Individuals that have said that time and a half after eight is not the industry practice, I beg to differ. We can provide, you know, work hours, and we'd be happy to do that in commercial and highway heavy industry that shows that accurately reflects that. Also, the individual that says that they're caring and this creates flexibility for the family, I think is a half-truth. Highway heavy industry, especially individuals that drive big equipment, make money not only off of the men and women that drive it, but primarily the piece of equipment that they're driving. If, in fact, time and a half after 40 goes into play, contractors in the highway industry will take advantage of that opportunity to profit by taking that equipment and running it as many hours a day as possible. Mr. Chairman, this bill is not good for Minnesota. It's not good for our families. It's not good for our workers. It does nothing but drive down construction workers' wages. And not one of our testifiers, although they commented on my People's Bill number one, which would talk about profits to construction companies, which we don't want to see, not one of them have talked about the impact that it's going to have on their company, because it won't. It will have an impact on the individuals in the audience here. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is to bring Dr. Jordan up and to talk a little bit about the mode. That will be the part of our presentation, and then we'll end up with our two final speakers.
Very well. Welcome to our committee, Dr. Jordan.
Thank you, Chairman Gunter and committee. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Scott for her interest in job creation. My concern about this bill is twofold. One, there's nothing about this bill that will create jobs in Minnesota. And secondly, I think there's a real misunderstanding about sort of the impact of the bill in general. So I just want to begin with an overview. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Lisa Jordan, and I'm an economist. I was asked several years ago when I was the chair of a business program to do some research on prevailing wage. At that time, I did that in support of the state auditor's report. And so that's mostly what I'm going to be speaking from today is the research I did. During that summer, I reviewed all the literature on both sides of the issue around prevailing wage to try to address the questions the state auditor at the time was looking at. In concurrence with the state auditor, or whichever way it went, you find when you look at that data that there's no studies that find a statistically significant impact on cost. So if we there seems to be two questions here that I'm hearing addressed. One, is the mode a good measure of typical wages paid? And two, is this going to save the state some money so that we can get more people to work? So I'm going to address the first question, or the second question first. Is this going to get more people to work? And in looking in that literature, what we find is that there's been tons of studies done in all different kinds of places. There's some data in the U.S., there's some data in Canada. People have looked at states where they've repealed prevailing wage laws. They've looked at places where there's been temporary repeals. They've looked at places where schools aren't covered and the state is covered. And they've looked in Canada. And if you take all that research together, you don't find anywhere where reducing the wages paid to the workers cuts costs. There's just no statistically significant impact. Now, there are other things you do find, but I want to address that question first because it seems counterintuitive, right? It seems like if you paid workers less, you would save money. So I want to address first what I heard some of the speakers in the first part, because I heard some of the contractors comparing the wages that they pay their workers in the private sector and then the wages they pay themselves workers in the public sector on prevailing wage laws, and they say there's such a big difference, we could save the state money. So in states, looking at the literature on this, in states where there are prevailing wage laws, on average, public sector works projects are between 21 and 27% more expensive than private sector jobs. Let me say that again. In states where there are prevailing wage laws, the cost of the projects are between 21 and 27% higher. But in states where there are no prevailing wage laws, that differential is 31%. Public sector jobs are 31% more expensive than private sector jobs. So there are differences in cost between public sector and private sector jobs. And economists have looked at this and tried to figure it out. And part of the idea is that perhaps it's because the state demands more in those contracts because the way bidding works, right, you have to take the lowest wage bidder. So on state projects, you're very clear about what you want, the kind of cement, the kind of lumber, the kind of quality labor. And that's what prevailing wage is about. It's about defining the kind of worker you want. You don't want the average worker. You want the best labor available for the price. That's basically what the prevailing wage law says, the best labor you can get. So it gets defined in that way. So first of all, there is a difference between public sector and private sector jobs, but that difference is even greater in non-prevailing wage states. Secondly, if we look at this, why is it then that you don't save any money when you use the when you reduce workers' wages? Well, for one thing, labor is a fairly, I don't want to say insignificant, but it's a smaller portion of the cost. And if you get the most qualified labor, so let's say we set the prevailing wage, and that means we're dictating the kind of labor we want. We want the best trained people who have been through apprenticeship programs. They know what they're doing. If we set a wage to get those workers, what we find is that we don't have cost overruns, that projects come in on time and at cost. When prevailing wage laws have been weakened or eliminated, you see cost overruns to the average about 5.5% to 6%. So you actually incur more costs for the state when you weaken or eliminate prevailing wage laws. And third is one that the state auditor and I had a conversation with, and I think I heard one of the other speakers quote what the auditor said. When you look at productivity of labor, it is difficult to study that and to say whether there's an actual return on your investment. So the literature is mixed on this. In economics, we call it efficiency wages. Do people work harder when they get paid more? And I think the literature is mixed. And the state auditor in his report, and I will defer to that, say that there's no real evidence to show out there. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. There's just no good studies. But what we do know is that if I'm an employer, if I'm a contractor, and I know that I'm going to pay $30 an hour for a worker, I'm going to make sure that I get the very, very best worker I can for that wage. That's how our system works. That's the incentive, right? So you know that you're going to get the best quality of labor on that project, not necessarily because the worker's going to work harder, but because my contractor brothers out here are smart enough to hire the best workers they can. So first point, you don't save money on projects when you cut prevailing wage. And in fact, you see cost overruns of about 5 to 6%, point one. The other thing we see that's really concerning to me about reducing or getting rid of prevailing wage, and there's studies that look at both, but on average we find a few things happen. One, apprenticeship programs decline in states. And in a time when we're really concerned about trying to get people educated for the jobs of the future, we don't want to lose our apprenticeship programs. So we're going to lower construction workers' wages. I mean, I just assume that that's the assumption here because people keep saying we're going to save money. But statistically, we do. The least that any of the studies find is a 4% reduction in wages when prevailing wages weakened. At the other end, we find about an 18% reduction in wages. And we find up to a 76% reduction in health care benefits. The reason is that most people in the construction industry go between employers. And so one of the beauties of having unions in the construction industry is often our health care benefits come through these joint programs, right? So if you get rid or weaken that model, then you use the health care. So that's important to remember. So we've weakened our apprenticeship programs, and that's also statistically found. You find that when prevailing wage laws are weakened, you get about a 16% increase in serious injuries on the job. So if we're just looking at this so far, we've reduced workers' wages, we haven't saved any money on the jobs, we've reduced our apprenticeship programs, we've had increased safety problems on the job, we have an increase in occupational injuries and worker compensation claims, and we have a reduction in health care costs. Now, all that means more costs to the state, right? Because you have a socialization of costs. If people can't afford, they don't have their own health care, they still have to get that coverage somewhere. The other part of this, though, is if workers are making less, and I did three different estimates, one at the 4%, one at the 8%, and one at the 18%, because those are the three studies that are out there. How's that going to impact state revenues? And what you find is that both in sales taxes and in income taxes, you significantly decrease state revenues. And I, you know, just when I was doing this data, because I wanted to be really honest about it, I said, okay, let's assume for a second what Representative Scott is saying. Let's assume for a second that if we reduce labor costs, you know, basic demand curve, micro 101, you increase demand for labor, or the quantity demanded for labor to be specific. So I said, let's say we reduce labor costs, we increase people employed, we still find a net loss in state revenues. So we have people out in our communities making less money to spend in their communities. The multiplier is 1.9. So for every dollar a construction worker loses, that's another dollar that goes away in the state. So that's two people then that aren't paying their taxes. They can't afford to pay as much in taxes. So if you look in the study, what I found was that revenues would decrease, income tax revenues would decrease anywhere between 13 and 61.7 million. Sales tax revenues would decrease between $5.6 and $26 million. So that's sort of the range of the decrease in revenues. So you haven't saved money by reducing workers' wages, and you might have increased costs on projects. You've weakened your programs, your apprenticeship programs. You've weakened the health care benefits that the people receive on a very dangerous job. More than 20% of all the workers that die on the job in the United States are construction workers. You've increased those injury rates, and you've reduced your revenues. So you've actually done the opposite of what Representative Scott's trying to do. She's trying to create jobs. What we've done is we've taken money out of the system, both so that you don't have as much money to spend, but also the people who are in those communities can't afford to go to the local movie theater anymore. So the thing about this bill is, it really, I said to somebody earlier, often, you know, there's data on both sides and your value judgments pull you one way or the other. In this, the data is so consistent. The state auditor said it. There are no savings costs here. All this is going to do is reduce workers' salaries and reduce your apprenticeship programs and increase injury rates if you look at the aggregate data. So that's the one side of it. What is this bill going to do to the state? The second side is, does the mode make sense? If we look at the data, and I think the gentleman from, I can't remember if it was a chamber or ABC, outlined the state data. So basically, nine states use the collectively bargained agreement. As an economist, I would say the collectively bargained agreement actually is the best indicator of what's actually happened, because you have very smart contractors who sit down at the table with the union. The union wants to get the best wages they can. The contractor wants to get the best deal they can. That's why 9 states have advocated for that, and that's what they do. That's not what we do in Minnesota. We do what is much more common, which is to start with the mode. So we're not really talking about, the law never says we want the average wage. What we want is, what is sort of the tendency, the predominant, the norm, the prevailing wage? So why use a mode over a mean? First of all, the mean is only used in one state in the country, and that's Tennessee. The median is used in one state in the country, and that is Maine. Every other state uses either the uses either the collectively bargained agreement, the Davis-Bacon rate, or the mode, and as the other speaker said, in some variation of that. So in Minnesota, what we've done for years is we've used the mode, the simple mode. So whatever the dominant value is what we use for that rate. There's two parts of calculating that. One is the survey, and the other part is actually the technical use of that. And I think if anybody had time from the other committee who's sitting here to read the report, I actually did make some recommendations about the survey process, about how we can increase responses to that, as Tennessee did. And so I think we can look at the survey process, which seems to be one of the concerns that Representative Scott had. She said only 26%, I think, of reporting. So there are some, you know, some questions about how we get more reporting. When we look at this data, and I heard somebody else refer to the deed as the gold standard. The deed isn't the gold standard for what you want to do today, because the deed is a self-reported data. So you ask me, what do I do? If I worked a construction project over the summer, I say, I'm a carpenter, and I made $10 an hour. Now, in the fall, I went back to college. Right? I never had any training as a carpenter. This isn't the person I hired. So the deed is not good data for what you want to do. That leaves us with the mode, the mean, and the median. We have heterogeneous data because we have people just sending in all the results. Most of these measures, the mode, the mean, and the median, assume that all the data is the same. So we're taking an average of all the data. So we have 10 exactly the same journeyman-trained carpenters, and we're looking at what their wages are. If you did that, and if that's what you had, then maybe you would probably end up with very close results from all that data. But what we have here is contractors reporting somebody they call a carpenter, and that definition can vary widely from somebody who's a very skilled person to somebody who's a much less skilled person. And so the mode, the intent of the mode, and the reason you mostly use the mode, is that it tries to get around that heterogeneity issue.
Time out. Just out of curiosity, isn't the deed data collected by the Department of Employment and Economic Development required by the federal government to be collected? And if that's so, why? If it's no good data?
No, sir. What I was saying is it's not good data for what you're trying to figure out here today. Because what the deed data does... I could actually say that.
Yes,
I'm impressed.
Real quickly.
What the deed data does is it says everybody that falls into a category, right? And it's self-reported. So like my brother who did construction work would report himself as a carpenter. And the intention of that data is to give broad categories. What you're trying to do is to say if we want quality construction, which is I think the state's interest, that's why when we bid out contracts we're very specific about everything on the project. So what we want to do is say we want quality labor. So what we want is we want journeyman carpenters. We want people who really know how to be pipe fitters. We don't want somebody who carried a tool belt for a plumber and called themselves a plumber when they self-reported what they did. So that's the difference in what the D data is. And if you look at the auditor's report, I don't remember if they explicitly ended up writing about this, but I know when we had our conversations, they had the same concerns. And that's why they didn't suggest making changes, because the mode is well within. I mean, all of these different measures have strengths and weaknesses. So if you have a factory and you're trying to decide how many T-shirts to make and in what size, you might get a list and find out that you have 10 people who need an, let's assume we're building trades. So we have 10 people who need an extra, extra large, right? And then their kids are going to be coming to the picnic too, and there's two of them who need smalls. Well, if you took the average, you'd buy mediums, right? That's why mean doesn't always work. I mean, you're not going to make manufacturing decisions based on that mean. So what you would do is you'd say, where's the predominant values? And you would go with, you know, 10 extra large. And so that, this is, I'm sorry, I hope that isn't, this is how I sort of describe this to my students when I teach statistics, okay? So that's the advantage of the mode. And that's why we look very specifically at which of these measures of central of tendency that we use in different situations. And that's why most states start out with a mode, because a mode tells us where most people in the range we want, what they make.
Go ahead.
So I'd just like to conclude by saying then, basically what I started out by saying, you know, prevailing wage is something that's very unique in some ways to this industry, because this industry, the industrial organization, is unique. It's an industry in which, and particularly when it's a public sector bid, you don't have the choice of not taking the lowest bid. When I get contractors at my house, I don't always take the lowest bid, because you can tell, you know, if somebody doesn't know how to measure, you don't hire them for the job, even if they're the cheapest. So that's why you specify things, and that's why we have prevailing wage, to make sure that part of that specification is a labor specification. What's been happening in Minnesota has been working. Every single state in the union does something different. Every single state has a different, slightly different way of doing this. And you'll see that in my report, I looked at every single state. They all do something different. If you compare what we're doing with the mode to sort of a Davis-Bacon outcome, according to the Minnesota taxpayers, you get substantially the same outcomes. So the mode works for Minnesota. If you change this, if you weaken it, if you cut workers' salaries, you are not going to save the state money, but you will hurt the men and women that work in this industry, and you will hurt the communities that they live in, because the multiplier is 1.9. For every dollar you take away from them, that's a dollar out of their community. You're going to hurt the state budget, because you're going to take tax revenues away. You're going to hurt apprenticeship programs, and particularly union apprenticeship programs, because women and people of color fare better in those programs, and you're going to have a rise in injuries on the job, and that's going to lead to an increase in socialization of costs with worker comp claims. The data is all there. This isn't one of those ones that the data is on both sides. The data is the prevailing wage is good for the state, and I advocate to keep it the way it is. Thank you.
This is not a sporting event. Thank you. John Nessie's next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Nessie. I represent a number of construction employer associations, carpentry, drywall, painting, flooring, mechanical insulation, and in the environmental industry. Prevailing wage systems are bidder qualification systems, and essentially what they do is they say a contractor can't bid on a state job unless he employs the right workforce. Why do we need that? It's because you and I don't get to pick the contractors like we would if we were fixing our house. What actually happens is the numbers pick the contractor, because we've got a low bid rule that says we need to pick the cheapest contractor among the bidders. Essentially, the prevailing wage system protects the state from choosing an unqualified contractor with an unqualified workforce. The mode system, the system we use right now, isn't perfect. But for every negative example, I think there are hundreds of success stories. It'd be awfully easy to go out, take a look at all the different state building projects over the last few years and see what's worked versus what happened, versus what didn't work, and I think you'd see a different story than the one that's being portrayed here today. If we switch from the mode to the mean, I think what we'll be doing is simply trading one set of problems for the other. The problem we got right now is that you hear occasional examples of guys getting a temporary raise to work on a state project. Occasional examples. If we switch from the mode to the mean, you'll start hearing about different problems. You'll start hearing about problems like contractors from Texas coming up to do state projects here. workers living in campers and motels while they work on state projects. The contract, those same contractors and workers taking all of our state tax dollars out of Minnesota back home where they came from. And like Lisa Jordan pointed out, you'll hear more problems about cost overruns from things like change orders, delays, safety issues, quality repair issues, or flat-out cheating because the contractor's going to know that he's not going to be in Minnesota next week and there's no reason to do the right thing here. Construction work is not a commodity. It's not the same from one contractor to the next. You can argue that projects need to be built to code, but what they really need to be built for is passing an inspection, and that's about it, because again, the contractor's leaving after the project's done. Use of the mode helps ensure that the state doesn't get taken advantage of. It helps ensure that the right contractors perform our state projects. And you know what? There are examples of workers getting a raise to work on a specific state project, but if that contractor still gets the low bid, I'd argue that there's still a success there because he's got a qualified workforce. If you change from the mode to the mean, the competition for that low bid will change along with it. You'll have different contractors bidding along with that same contractor, and he's probably not going to get the project anymore. You'll bring unqualified contractors with their unqualified workforces into the running to build our state buildings. Dr. Jordan, PhD in economics from Notre Dame, tells you that there's no cost savings to be had here. There's a lot at risk, and you need to consider that. I hope you'll consider that. The question here is, who do you want building our state projects? You can require the highest quality of labor, or you can require an average quality of labor. And if you want to talk about money, do you want the cheapest of the best contractors, or do you want the cheapest of the average contractors? Because remember, you're married to that low bid process. I'd encourage you to keep the mode in place, keep the system as it is, and keep our buildings the way they are. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Shari Wilson. Welcome to our committee. Very nice name, by the way.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shari Wilson, and I work as a truck driver for Schaefer Contracting. And I would never have believed just 3 years ago that I would be a member of the Teamsters Local 120, or would I be here today again testifying to protect my livelihood. Prior to my job with Schaefer, I spent 25 years of my life in the management side of the security industry. That ended when the recession of 2008 hit. I was laid off of the job that I held overseeing control centers for two high-rise buildings in downtown Minneapolis. As the breadwinner for my family and the mother of a child with extensive medical needs, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I didn't know what to do. I was scared. Fortunately, I was able to get free training and job placement with the Minnesota Teamsters Apprenticeship Program. I had never, ever envisioned myself, me, behind the wheel of a multi-ton vehicle. I spent 25 years in the alarm industry. Now I'm behind the wheel of a multi-ton vehicle to make a living. I did what I had to do to pay the mortgage, to put food on the table, and to provide health care for my son. While my friends and my neighbors were having their homes foreclosed, and ending up on government programs, I was able to make ends meet. I am living on way less than I used to, way less than I used to. But we are getting by. I'm here today to strongly urge you to consider how changes to the prevailing wage law will negatively impact families like mine. With the gas prices getting higher, food prices going up, every cent literally matters. And I'm not exaggerating. Every cent for me makes a difference. What may look like minor changes to the prevailing wage law may have a big impact. So please give serious consideration to people like me and my son when making your decision. Please protect the middle class and leave the prevailing wage law as is. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have John Junker. Legislative Auditor. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess I'm John Junker from the Legislative Auditor's Office. In 2007, we released a report on the prevailing wage laws. So I guess that's why I'm being asked to testify, and I'm probably not here to make anybody happy, because I'm neither a proponent of the legislation being proposed or a proponent of the existing law. Our report was a report that looked at prevailing wage laws, and we didn't endorse any particular method of calculating the prevailing wage. I think endorsing a particular method requires some value judgments and policy decisions about what the state is trying to accomplish with the prevailing wage law, and I think our position would be that that's your role as elected officials to make those value judgments and policy decisions, and not the role of the legislative auditor. We did, however, in doing this study, look at various claims that were made either by proponents or opponents of prevailing wage laws, and we assessed those claims based on the evidence that was there. I just want to make, before I make a few comments about our report, I just want to correct some things that I heard being said here. Lisa Jordan said that she did work in support of the legislative auditor. I think she said state auditor. She did not work for us. Her work was commissioned by the Building Trades Council. And I believe they commissioned that work because they wanted to present to us their position and support for that position. So we did meet with Lisa Jordan and people at the Building Trades Council, but that work was not done for us. That was commissioned by the labor group. And I just want to assure you that we also met with the merit contractors and the ABC contractors and so on, so that we would get a full array of views on all these issues. What I do want to say about the way the rate is being calculated currently is that it's really difficult. And one thing we tried to do was to determine if prevailing wage rates were representative of the wage and benefit rates that were being paid in the commercial and heavy construction industries. It's really difficult to answer that question, because there really is no good source of data to say, well, these are the rates being paid in those industries. You've heard it mentioned that, well, we could look at the deed data. The problem with the deed data is not only does it include wage and benefit rates on individuals who are working in those industries, but it includes wage rate and benefit rate, wage rates. It doesn't include benefit rates. It includes wage rates for those who are working in residential construction or would be handymen working in a construction-related area. And it's well known that the wage rates being paid in residential construction are well below what's being paid in the private sector for commercial and heavy construction. So to try to make that comparison is inappropriate. And it doesn't help you to look at that and say, well, here's the prevailing wage rates. How do they compare to wage rates in the industry? That's not the same industry. Having said that, though, we did look at, and I provided you with three handouts. One was a copy of the summary to our report. One was a copy of how prevailing wage rates were calculated in other states. Of course, that's as of when we completed that study, probably late 2006 or early 2007. And so that could have changed. And the third handout was about, gave you some examples of how the prevailing wage rate can be calculated or may be calculated. They're real examples. And it also had a table in there that showed what percentage of the, when the mode is used, what percentage of the wages does it represent that are being reported in the Department of Labor and Industry survey. And what we said in the report was that in 2005, about 6% of the prevailing wage rates were based on only 20% or fewer of the compensation rates that were reported in the survey. So if one thinks the survey is at least somewhat representative of the industry, and there certainly are doubts about that because of a low response rate, because of our using the mode, there are occasions in which the prevailing wage rates are based on a very small percentage of those rates. And the examples show it can work both ways. It can be that the high rate is picked, or the low rate, or something in the middle. The reason that this happens is because Minnesota, unlike the federal government and many states that use the mode, Minnesota does not require the mode to represent a minimum percentage of the reported rates. And so if you look at the table that I provided, I believe it's called Table 1.6, State Methods for Calculating Prevailing Wage Rates, you can see that at the time we did the study, six states simply used collective bargaining rates to calculate prevailing wage rates. They didn't have any survey, just what are the collective bargaining rates? Five states used a simple mode. Minnesota is one of them. But then there were five states and another nine states and another one state that used the mode. But if the mode doesn't represent a high enough percentage of all the rates that are being reported in the survey, then they go to another method. So they would go to the average or mean, or they would go to, in one case, the median. And then there are only two states that use the average or mean alone, and those are Tennessee and Vermont. But when you look at Minnesota and look at all the states using the mode, at least initially using the mode, most of the states that use the mode say, if we're going to use the mode, then it has to represent at least 30% or 40% or 50, 51% of all the rates being reported in the survey for that job class in that area, or else they don't use the mode and they go to the average or mean. So I think that kind of puts in context our comments about the method for using either the mode or the mean or something else. Those are the comments in our report. Let me just comment on one other item that I heard mentioned today, and that was that Lisa Jordan said that the legislative auditor said there were no savings from eliminating the prevailing wage rate. You go to the summary of the report, you go to the first page of that summary, the top of the right column, it says research does not provide a clear answer about how prevailing wage laws affect public construction costs or construction quality. And then you go to the last page, the far right column, it elaborates that on that a little bit more. But we didn't say that eliminating the prevailing wage law or changing the prevailing wage law would have this precise effect, as she seemed to be saying. What we said was there is no clear answer, and if you know our report, if you look in it in more detail, we review all the different types of reports that have looked at this issue and what they've found, and we critique them. And our assessment, having looked at all those reports and critiquing them, is there is no clear answer as to how the prevailing wage law affects construction costs. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments, and if the committee has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Melander, have we given sufficient time to you that we should start asking questions?
Mr. Chairman, you have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We want to make sure it's a fair hearing, and I really appreciate your input. Members, you got any questions that you'd like to ask any of the testifiers that are still here?
Yes, I have a couple questions. Let me just get one simple one out of the way. The last testifier, maybe Representative Scott, you might be able to answer this. He said we have to have over 30% or 35% of the inputs within the county to make mode, using the mode figure, valid. Words to that effect. Did you hear what he said?
Did he leave?
Representative Scott.
Oh, he's right here.
Oh. Mr. Yunker, come on down.
Come on.
Would you repeat the question?
Yes. In your testimony, correct me if I'm wrong, because I think this is an important point, and I think this is why you basically said, you know, I can't come up with a good answer one way or the other, which is basically what you're saying about your report. And that is that you're not getting enough data. You're not getting enough survey data. You need at least, did you say you needed at least 30% return information before you can make before you can actually use the mode to determine prevailing wages? Did I hear you say that correctly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, no, I think I was making that statement in reference to something else. I do think there is an issue with what kind of response rate the Department of Labor and Industry is getting from their survey. That clearly is an issue. But I think what you're talking about, the 30%, 40%, 50%, what I was saying is that Minnesota, unlike a lot of other states who use the mode, does not require that 30 or 40 or 50% of the reported rates must be at the mode in order to use the mode. These other states, if you don't have 30 or 40 or whatever the legislatively determined percentage is, you don't have a majority of the rates at the mode, they go to the average. So they're kind of a two-part system. We use the mode, but if it doesn't represent enough of the reported rates, we go to the average.
Well, may I continue, Mr. Chairman? Then I think I did hear you correctly then. Now, the other states are using their return data is 30% or more. We don't require that here. Is that true?
We don't, Mr. Chairman and Representative. We do not require that.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have further questions, but it's really for Dr. Jordan, if I can ask her some.
You have a question for the witness? We have quite a few questions all of a sudden here.
Ms. Bianca? One more?
Just a second. We get one for this witness here.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Yunker, would you say that using the mode would be the best way of determining the central tendency of distribution?
Mr. Yunker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, what I said is we don't support any particular method. I think that it involves a policy decision as to what you want to do with the prevailing wage rate and what you think the purpose is. And so we did not take a position on what the best method is to use for calculating the prevailing wage rate.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We have six people have questions. Do you want to?
If that's... I'd like to ask a question. First of all, I have two bills on prevailing wage, and I'm a new legislator, and I've been working on this issue. One of the bills is to use median plus X percentage, and another is to just basically do away with the current state prevailing wage and revert back to it. So I've got your report, and I have some questions about it. Has this ever been peer reviewed at all?
Miss. Very quickly, first I want to apologize. Oh, I'm sorry, Chairman and Committee. First of all, I want to be very clear. When I said that I wrote this report in support of the work that the State Auditor was doing, at the time the Auditor's Office had issued a request for comment, and so I did all the research for this report in response to that. So when I said I did it in support of their work, that's what I meant. I was not working for the State Auditor's Office. So I just wanted to, and I spoke to him about that. In response to your question, the answer would be my report, sir, was not peer-reviewed, but all the studies documented in my report are peer-reviewed. And I included both the T-Bolt study, which is someone who advocates for getting rid of prevailing wage, as well as the Proust studies and others that typically support prevailing wage. So the study includes both reports. The part of my report that I did myself is the part of the report that estimates the revenue loss from using prevailing wage. The rest is just basically a literature review of the data, much like the auditor's office did when they reviewed the data.
Well,
Representative Wendinger.
Mr. Chairman, and then I look at the bottom of it. It's a study funded by the Quality Construction Coalition. Can you tell me what that organization is and who that organization is?
Yes, sir. As I, you have to forgive me, it was 5 years ago. The Quality Construction Coalition was a group of building trades and unionized contractors who wanted an independent review of all the literature. And so they contacted me and asked me if I would review all the literature that had been written on prevailing wage. And that's why I said in this summary, because I was trying to do it to support, I say support, what I mean is I was doing this research to give it to the auditor's office and then have a conversation with them. So that's why in this I reviewed all the literature on both sides and tried to look at that literature, much as what the state auditor's office was going to do. But they did fund the time I spent reviewing that literature.
So they paid for, thank you, Mr. Chair. So they paid for this. This is and this is mainly a group. This is mainly a union group. Then that
Mr.
That paid
Chairman,
for this?
Committee members. This was a group of building trades and unionized contractors who asked me as an economist to review all the literature and give them a report of what all the literature said. So I reviewed every single study that I could find that had been done in the U.S. and Canada and that had been peer-reviewed and published. Okay. So I reviewed all that literature, wrote it in a literature review here, and that's what is in this document. And I did this along with three other economists.
Just really one last comment. I mean, I've been trying to study this issue, and I heard you talk about this, and I have, and I really appreciate Representative Scott's bill, which is very different than my other two bills, really talking about the mean. And I don't know how you really came to those conclusions, so I kind of question, because you basically said mean just isn't going to work. An average doesn't work, but in our case, when we're not getting the kind of data here in this state in order to ever really go to mode, I mean, I would think that mean makes a lot of sense.
Chairman, committee.
So I question what you have here.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I think what I tried to say was that every state in the union has a slightly different way of calculating the prevailing wage rate. And so in some states, as was laid out in the auditor's report, many states use the collectively bargained rate. In some states, there's committee structure to determine the prevailing wage on particular projects. In one state, they use the mean. In another state, they use the median, as I understand it. And then there are a few states that use the simple mode. And then there's a number of states who use a mode at some percentage. And what I tried to say was, given all these different rates and looking at it statistically, I don't see a reason to make this is a huge jump. If you went from the mode to the average, it's a big change in sort of the policy of what the prevailing rate is meant to do, in my estimation. And I don't see any, in reviewing this, I didn't see any reason to make that jump, particularly because the State Taxpayers Association, when they did their study, they found that the mode didn't come to substantially different results than the Davis-Bacon approach. In Minnesota, only 51% of all modes come to be the collectively bargained rate. In 49% of the places, it's actually the mode in that area.
Well, my
as
last...
I understand it based on the data I collected, excuse me.
My last comment, and then I'll release the floor here. To me, the average rate seems to be the most prevailing rate. I mean, we can get to an average, and we can get to it at every county. And some counties are going to go up, some are going to go down. I mean, there's when you're using the average rate. But when you're using the average rate, it seems to me it is the definition of prevailing wage. Just that's my comment.
Mr. Chairman, committee, as I tried to say in my testimony, a mode, a mean, and a median with perfect data, they come out very similar. So the median, if you had people all the same, they would come out essentially the same. The problem is, in the data we're collecting, we have such a range. And this is why I think, and I don't want to speak for the auditors, but this is why I think one of the issues is, what is it we're trying to do? As I understand what I read in prevailing wage legislation, it's about getting the best labor for the cost. The average is not the rate that's paid for the best labor. I mean, it's not the average pay. The best players in the NFL do not get the average pay. They get the best pay. So the mode, the mean, and the median are all ways of looking at central tendency, but I don't know that the prevailing rate is the same thing as central tendency.
Representative Swedinski.
Thank you, Chair Gunther. My question to you, Ms. Jordan, I want to thank you for the time you've taken to join us here today. You know, looking at some of your research, you talk a little bit about the kind of the preponderance of evidence. I'm not a economist by any means, but is there some statistical basis? You know, when we're going through those process of doing some analysis for that standard or.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I want to make sure I understand the question. Are you asking me about whether to use the mode, the mean, or the median? If there's analysis of that part.
Well, yeah. When we're talking about when you've done this, this overall review. You talk about the evidence that comes out from that. You know, is there a statistical basis that you can run that through? To create that standard in which you're coming to your conclusions and that or.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I think what I said in the report is that I think there are strengths and weaknesses of using, as I said, all 50 states use different methods. I think in the report, I did talk about the way the data was collected and trying to do things like Tennessee did to increase response rates or doing what Wisconsin did to increase response rates. So I think that if you have good data, I think that's the most important part in trying to figure out what the prevailing wage should be is the data collection process. And I think I would agree with what the auditor's office said that in thinking about which one of these you want to choose, and in some ways it is more of a political decision because as I read the legislation, it says the best quality of labor that you can get because you have to take the lowest bid contract, right? And so where there are weaker prevailing wage laws, so workers make less, you get cost overruns. That's a political decision, right? The mode will, on average, I think, in most places lead to a higher wage. I think that's a real possibility, and it's certainly what the bill is based on, is that we're going to lower wages. But there's only one state that uses the mean, and it's the data problem. Since you have heterogeneous data, you can't just take an average. It was my example of T-shirts. You don't want to take the average between the extra larges and the smalls because you don't get a good result. So it's a data issue. So you've got to look at the data you have and figure out the best method based on that data. I don't want that.
Mr. Chair? Yes. If I'm going to kind of filter that out, using the preponderance and using the limited areas that we're able to look at, being the one state, to analyze that. Sorry about that. It's probably a little tough to get to, kind of a scientific analysis of that. Would you kind of say that's more kind of going to be a professional judgment on some of your,
Mr. Chairman, committee, I would say that is looking at the data that you have and using a professional judgment and, as the auditors often say, what is your goal? Is your goal to get the best quality of labor on the projects and in a form that the state can afford? And I apologize, I misstated, but my looking at the evidence is there is no, I see no evidence that weakening prevailing wage laws saves the state money. I think the auditor's office said, based on the evidence, they can't make a decision. But however that's framed, if we're not going to save the state money, it doesn't seem to me to change a method that could reduce wages. So that's a value judgment on my part, and basically looking at the data that I did. I will say that when I did this report, I tried to get the data that was collected so that we could do an analysis to see what different rates, how it would impact the data. At the time, they didn't have the data sets in a format that we could do that. And if I was thinking of a way of saving money, I don't know if they fixed that since then, but you would expect that would be an Excel spreadsheet. You could do some simple calculations. But when I tried to get that data, we couldn't do that. So it was something I tried to do, what you're asking me about, but the data just wasn't available to make those calculations.
Thank you, Dr. Jordan. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Next, Representative House.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There were a few of the people when they testified against it, and there were so many people and so many names. I'm not sure which one it was, but my question is, they kept saying saving taxpayer dollars. So I'd like to know what they meant by that. Was that money that citizens of Minnesota had in their pocket, or was it money they gave to the state, and now we're talking as it was taxpayer dollars? And then while we could find somebody to answer that, the auditor person, if he could come up and answer a question.
Person who made that statement, if they could come up, it would be appreciated. Mr. Junker, could you please come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me I know this isn't your forte, but as an auditor and someone who looks over things, will this affect capital projects in any fashion, to the negative, to the plus side? Will it save money, cost more money?
Mr. Yunker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, first let me just, because I keep hearing it repeated, state auditor, we're the legislative auditor.
I said auditor person.
You didn't say that, but I was hearing it before. Our position, is spelled out in the report as to, what we think the impact of prevailing wage laws are. And as I said before, after reviewing all the literature, we say that research does not provide a clear answer on how prevailing wages affect public construction costs or construction quality. We also go into more detail about how it might affect injury rates. We heard that discussed a little bit today. How it would affect training and other issues, and that's all in the report. There are, it's been 4 years since I've been working on this report, and I could tell you more today about sex offenders than I could tell you about prevailing wage laws, because that's what I've been working on. Please, but you don't want to hear that. What we did say was, I believe that for training, that there are some studies that suggest that the prevailing wage laws increase training among construction workers. There are some studies that link prevailing wage laws with lower rates of construction injuries, but we do raise some questions about whether those results are valid or not. We do say, because the research seems fairly strong on this, that prevailing wage laws, the existence of prevailing wage laws, seem to increase the wages and fringe benefits received by construction workers throughout the construction industry. Not just necessarily on public projects, but on all projects. And the evidence there is a little stronger than it is anywhere else.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, so if this bill were to pass and become law, would that lower that?
Mr. Junker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative House, those studies look at whether you have a prevailing wage law or whether you don't. They don't look at whether you have a prevailing wage law that uses the mode versus having a prevailing wage law that uses the mean. So I don't know what the answer to that question would be. Most of the studies that look at these things don't look at variations on the prevailing wage law. They look at, do you have a prevailing wage law or don't you have a prevailing wage law?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if Deed or Dolly or any state agency that does spend state money on building projects were here to answer a question, that would be helpful.
Representative Mahoney would like to talk to ask a question, Mr. Younger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Younger, your study, the legislative auditor study, was done in 2007. The Minnesota Taxpayer League paid for study was done in 2004 or 5. Did you look at that study and still come up with the we can't tell answer when you did your study?
Mr. Young,
did you look at the Minnesota Taxpayer League study also?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, absolutely, we looked at that study. The major concern about that study is they compare Deed collected wage rates to the prevailing wage laws. They also have to the prevailing wage rates. The prevailing wage rates include fringe benefits. The Deed ones don't. As I said before, the main problem with using Deed data is it includes not only the heavy and commercial construction workers, but it includes workers who are working on residential construction, or handymen, or Lisa Jordan's brother, who happens to do a little work in construction. And typically, the workers in heavy construction and commercial construction earn higher wage rates and have higher fringe benefits than those residential construction workers. So the Deed data is a mix of all of these. And if what you're trying to do is to say, let's look in a prevailing wage law, let's look at the commercial construction industry, and based on the wage rates that are paid and benefit rates that are paid in that industry, what should our prevailing wages be? The Deed data doesn't help because it includes everything in there.
Thank you.
Okay. You're in the list.
I wasn't done.
Representative Stenswood.
Larry's not done yet.
Oh, Larry, are you done?
I wasn't done, but I could wait another turn.
Well, you don't have to wait another turn. It's a long ways down, so
well,
go for it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't see anybody here from DNR, Department of Corrections, Department of Human Services, no one from state agencies that can tell us this is going to save money or cost more money. I keep hearing from people that testify but don't want to come up now and admit who they are or explain about we save taxpayer dollars. And, Mr. Chairman, I want to know if this is going to save the state money or cost the state money. My committee wants to know that. I'm not going to make that motion today. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask you all, out of a courtesy, to lay this bill over. Now, I don't want to vote it down right now, but I want to lay it over until we can get state agencies in here and tell us what they think and give us more information. And I'd make that a motion, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask for a roll call.
Fine. We'll make a motion. However, because of the time that we're in the session and the fact that it still has another stop, one at least, where we can get that data that you want, I oppose the motion.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I could withdraw the motion if you'd tell me where this is going.
Is this debatable?
This is going to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, I beg your patience here for a moment. When we pass something to Ways and Means, it's very typical they don't have testimony. Is there a motion of sorts that I could make that if this goes to Ways and Means that we must have testimony from state agencies?
I could certainly make that effort.
I'm going to make that motion, and if staff can word it and we can vote on it in that fashion, I would like that, Mr. Chairman, and then I will
not raise a ruckus and ask for a roll call vote on this going to my committee.
Okay.
Today.
We'll do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chairman, that would be my motion that we add that language.
Representative Howell, you have to withdraw your motion.
I'll withdraw the other one first, Mr. Chairman, and then the second one I talked to you about, if staff could work something out, I would like to move that motion.
Very well.
And I won't ask for a roll call vote.
Okay.
What is the I don't understand.
Yeah. The motion is that he will withdraw his motion to have someone from labor and have the bill laid over unless there's someone from labor. We have somebody from labor and industry here. Will that be suffice?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome to our committee.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman. John Rakuski with the Department of Labor and Industry.
Representative Howells has a question.
Representative Howells, I'll do my best to just provide some of the new members and new members to this committee and the freshmen a little history on the prevailing wage enforcement legislation that passed in 2007 and then was again revised, I believe, in 2009. And during those negotiations with the proponents of prevailing wage enforcement, the early version, I think Representative Mullery is very familiar with this, was that the department was going to be the repository, if you will, of all the wage and hour data in order the certified payroll, that was the term I was looking for. We negotiated with the Department of Administration and other agencies, including DEED, the PFA, the Minnesota Zoo, the MNSCU, the DNR, I think that's all of them, since they're the contracting agencies, that they keep the payroll records, okay? I know what you're asking for, because I've been thinking about this, listening to the testimony, is how do we get our head around this? And I think you would have to go to every single agency and ask them how it would affect them, each one independently. We do not have that data, in short.
Representative Howe? Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I can't tell Chairman Holberg what to do. I don't know that anybody can, so.
I wasn't looking forward to
it. I guess I'm going to have to sit down and shut up and keep my powder dry and reload later.
Very well. With that, we have several other people. Representative Mahoney would like to ask some questions to...
I have just one question to the testifier.
Mr. Rakowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rakowski, has the governor taken a position on this bill at all, for or against it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, no.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, you got a question for Mr. Rakowski? Okay. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Lemire.
My question will be for Dr. Jordan, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Jordan. Welcome back.
Thank you. I should have brought my numbers.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Jordan. On page 4 of your report, I don't know if I can find it, it says 16 states have designated the mode rate as the prevailing wage by rule or law. And according to this paper that was just handed out by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, it says there's 5 that use the simple mode. Could you explain?
Yes, sir. If you look on page, let me find it. I think it's 70.
70?
Yes, if you look on page 70 of my report.
I'm on the web here, so.
Oh, I apologize. Bear with me.
How did you know? Oh, right there. Okay, page 70.
Okay, so if you look on page 70,
what I did was, oh, Mr. Chairman, committee, I apologize. So what I tried to do is I tried to go through and summarize for each state that had prevailing wage, the state, the method, the threshold, and then the penalty. What you're referring to on page four was sort of the executive summary. So in this chapter where this summary is, I go through and I specify pretty much exactly what the auditor said, is that there's I think, five states that do the simple mode. There's another 10 that do some variation. So Wyoming and I believe Nebraska, I can't remember off the top of my head, use 30%. Other states do the mode at 50% or 50% plus one. And so this page would reflect something very similar to what the auditor's office passed out, except that I also talk about penalties and thresholds because I was trying to be as specific as I could and refer to the statutes that designated how it's measured. So I think what you were looking at is the executive summary. If you look at the chapter, it's much more detailed.
Right, it was, it was the executive summary. And that's why when you look at this, there's not 16 states that use the simple mode. There's five.
Oh, no, sir, there's five. And I didn't say the simple mode. I just said, Mr. Chairman.
I apologize, sir.
I was trying to say that there's that many states that start with the mode, and then some of them use the simple mode, and some of them use a mode that, like Wyoming, uses 30% or some of the other states that use the 50% threshold.
Right, so it would have been just as easy to say a majority. Because you could say that minimum percentage average, majority percentage average could be considered an average, too. Then you could have went both ways on that. You could have easily said there's 11 states that use average.
Dr. Jordan.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I wouldn't agree with what you're saying. I apologize, because they're using the mode as the primary measure, and where the mode is not met as a criteria, then they looked at a weighted mean. So what I would say is that if I was to phrase it, I would say the plurality of states use the collectively bargained rate. If you want to designate each of these, then there's the next highest number would be the simple mode. The next highest number, I'm not sure I'm putting these exactly right order, would be something very similar to Davis-Bacon. The next highest number, so I would go down like that. The least often used would be the mean.
If you interpret it that way, but I mean, because I would say the majority and the average should have been listed separately on your summary in the beginning, because it could easily be the majority uses the average to figure out
that. George.
Mr. Committeeman, committee, I think in some ways what we're talking about is semantics and categorization. What I was trying to say is that in most of these states that use the mode, it's very much like what happens in Minnesota, is that the majority of the areas will end up with the modal rate, and where they don't have the mode, they go to the weighted average. And so in Minnesota, we use the mode all the way across the board, as do those other states. So I mean, it's all laid here in the chapter, and I categorize them by which kind the state uses. And also, some states, it's at the discretion of the Department of Labor, which one they use, whether they use the collective bargaining rate, the mode rate.
Thank you.
The author of the bill would like to make a comment.
I just had a simple question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Ms. Jordan. My understanding is in those states where they have the percentage threshold that they try to meet, that it, I guess, explain to me what a weighted average is, because to me what they do is if they don't reach that threshold, then they just use, according to these definitions from the legislative auditor's report, they just use a straight average. How is that weighted?
Dr. Jordan.
Mr. Chairman, committee, a weighted average just means if you have 10 people who report $10 an hour, you multiply the 10 by the 10 people by the $10, and then you average it. So you're not just taking one time 10, because then you wouldn't get a good reflection. So a weighted average just means if you have more people making that wage, that's included in the average.
It just doesn't say that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next. Representative Sanders isn't there. Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Jordan, we've talked a lot about literature and data until we're almost cross-eyed. What criteria, when you were choosing studies, what criteria did you actually take in choosing the studies that you reviewed?
Mr. Chairman, committee, I actually reviewed every single study I could find. So if you look back, and I think it's in section, the first chapter is just sort of a review of the history. Sorry, just a second. I think it's section 2 of the report that begins on page, section 3 that begins on page 17. What I start out by saying is there's a lot of debate around this. And so I tried to look at every single study I could find. So as I said, Dr. Tebold, who is somebody who's done a lot of work for the ABC, they funded a lot of his studies in the past, I cite his studies in here. I cite the Taxpayers Association study. So I took every single study I could from data from the U.S. and Canada, and then I tried to categorize them by the kind of study they were, whether they looked at a state where prevailing wage was repealed, whether they looked at a state where they weakened prevailing wage, if it was cross-sectional data like the University of Missouri did in their study. So in this chapter, I tried to include every single study that I could find, an empirical study that had been done on prevailing wage on both sides of the argument. So you'll find actually, just for the committee's fodder, that the one study that I found that seemed to find a significant impact in prevailing wage costs on construction projects was on low-income housing in California. That was the one study that seemed to be the outlier that seemed to show that prevailing wage had an impact on costs. It's random, but that's the one study I found, and it's cited in this report, and I talk about why that might have happened. So this report, I tried to include studies on both sides of the argument.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Dr. Jordan, and you mentioned peer review. So for all the studies that you cite and include in your study here, were they all peer-reviewed and published?
Dr. Jordan.
Mr. Committee, and, committee, they were not. So, for example, I cite the Taxpayers Association study. That was never peer-reviewed and published. That was a study that they did of Minnesota that they put out. So the Taxpayers Association wasn't. If you look at the study, I have the bibliography. The ones that were published, so most of the stuff that was published by the folks, Proust, if you see that name, most of those are peer-reviewed, published studies that looked at cross-sectional data. So if you go through, you can sort of find the ones. So there's ones that were published in books. Typically, if something's published in a book, for example, The Economics of Prevailing Wage Laws, there's a study called Introduction to Prevailing Wage Regulations and Public Policy in the Construction Industry. That was published in a book, so it was reviewed by the editors, but if you mean peer-reviewed in the sense of being a journal publication, it wasn't necessarily. It's kind of like my paper. My paper wasn't peer-reviewed and published in a journal, but it's what got me tenure. So it was reviewed by my colleagues at my university. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Dr. Jordan, are you familiar with the Journal of Labor Research? And I'm wondering if you consider it a top journal in labor economics?
Dr. Jordan.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, committee, the Journal of Labor Research is a journal in my field. It's not one that I would probably publish in, and I wouldn't consider it a top journal. The top journal is a journal that's published out of Cornell.
Okay.
And it's something that is more often published in by conservatives.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'm assuming the Journal of Labor Research, is that peer-reviewed?
Mr. Chairman, committee, yes, the Journal of Labor Research is a peer-reviewed journal.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Stenzel.
Thank you. And then maybe one last question for the doctor. Are you familiar with the paper on prevailing wages? It was published in the Journal of Labor Research by Mike Clark in 2005.
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm looking to see in my review because I have quite a few things, like all the articles by Dr. Tebolt were published in the Journal of Labor Research, so I'm looking back because I don't specifically remember that, so I'm looking to see if it's in my bibliography. Mr. Chair, committee, that is an article that I do not have included in my paper. I did not see that article when I was doing my review.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rooney, that was one of my questions. I was wondering why that one might have been missing.
Yeah. So. Mr. Chair, committee, I don't have that one, but if you do look in my review, you'll see that I do have a number of articles by Mr. Tebolt, Dr. Tebolt, and he's considered actually sort of the foremost expert on the anti-prevailing wage side, and most of his work was published in the Journal of Labor Research. So that's where he publishes his work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for the author, Representative Scott. I was wondering if you could walk the committee through the fiscal note that's attached to your bill. Maybe that could answer some of Representative Howell's questions.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moline. I think the notes on the back are pretty self-explanatory. We do not necessarily agree with everything that's on here, but a lot of the expenses would be for updating the computer system so that that would figure the mean instead of the mode. And you might want to have the department come down and speak to this. Actually, it's from them. I don't know if Mr. No.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Scott, what are the cost savings that are in your fiscal note?
Representative Scott.
To the department, none.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the main cost would be implementing rule change, because obviously the calculation of the mode is in the rule. And lawyers are expensive. Trying to light things up here a little bit. That's the main. And
we should have a prevailing wage for those, Mr. Chairman.
our chief counsel likes to say she gets paid by the word, Representative. And we also would anticipate legal challenges. In my previous two commissioners ago, there was another little history lesson, but the commissioner at that time tried through rule to change what was called the dual wage of apprenticeship. It's been mentioned about training. The prevailing wage applies to beginning apprentices, and that was the administration at that time tried to make a rule change, and it was very costly, and the department was not successful in that. So rulemaking can be very expensive depending on how many challenges there are and how many hearings. I hope that helps.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Scott.
At this time, I'd like to offer an amendment, and I'd like to have the representative from the department stay here and address this amendment. What it would do is currently in law, all this reporting business that we've been talking about is required to be done annually, and this would take it to an every other year basis. And I know after talking with the department, this would save them a lot of man hours and a lot of time. There's just a few people, as I understand it, that have to go through a very deep stack of papers every year to determine the accuracy of the prevailing wage. So I'm hoping this would save quite a bit of money, maybe cut the cost nearly in half. So I would like to move that amendment.
Okay, the author moves the A3 amendment. Pardon me? I will move the A3 amendment, and I would solicit input from Mr. Rakowski when you finish reading it.
Well, I just got it. We have discussed it in theoretically that it would save the department money, but I'm not prepared at this time to give you an exact amount. I'm sorry. It certainly would cut down on it is very labor intensive. We're going through it right now, actually. This every spring is when the surveys go out, and I believe it's May now, so they're probably in the process of calculating. What does the fiscal note say? How many different. If you call your attention to the first paragraph in the bill description in the fiscal note, I mean, we're talking about 21,000 prevailing wage rates. So it would obviously save money. I'm not prepared to give you an exact amount. I'm sorry.
Mr. Rakowski, could you ask your department to prepare a fiscal note on this?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Well, Mr.
Representative Moline.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess, you know, if Representative Scott offers this amendment and it does get attached to the bill, then I would have to make a motion to lay this bill over because we don't even have an adequate fiscal note attached to the bill if this amendment is added on.
We can take care of that in ways and means. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm still going to make the motion if this amendment gets added on to the bill.
Okay. Would you like to restate your motion?
Well, I don't think that, Mr. Chair, I don't think we've voted on the amendment yet.
Okay. All in favor of...
Mr. Chair, can I ask a quick question?
Representative Clark.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a quick question. Do you know, Representative Scott, or maybe I should ask Mr. Rakowski, what is the average kind of fluctuation in the findings of the actual wage each year? Do you have any sort of historical, I mean, what are we talking about here? Are there very minor changes that this would affect, or are we talking about very really serious changes based on economic conditions?
Mr. Rakowski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, it would be determined in two ways. The level of response, and remember, commercial rates are done 87 counties. There are some counties, unfortunately, where there isn't enough construction activity, and we get a lack of response, so they're called empty rates. And so that county doesn't have a rate for that year, so what they do is they go to the next county that does have rates. But to your precise speculation about how much prevailing wages change from year to year, I'm not prepared to answer that. I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, well, perhaps the maker of the motion has some idea about that beyond that. You know, since this is an important issue, you must have thought about this or tried to find out.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I don't have that data.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Representative Scott, do you plan to get it for us or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I can sure get that for you. I would have to go through the department to get that.
Representative Moline, are you finished? We have a motion made by you.
We haven't voted on the amendment.
We haven't voted on the amendment, okay. I would solicit any input on the amendment that anybody wants to give us. Welcome to our committee again.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in response to the question regarding the impact that a biannual survey would have, I think it's pretty obvious, and you know, with not only within the world of the folks that we represent, but also those employers that are not part of our organization, we're assuming that with the cost of living that those increases would go up, and there's also a possibility that those wages, depending upon the economic conditions of not only tomorrow or in the future, actually might go down. So I think that taking a survey, even though it is a burden annually, actually would be a much better way to get an accurate reflection of what wages are from all parties within the state of Minnesota if, in fact, it was done on an annual rate.
Very well. Any other comment anybody would like to make on the amendment? Seeing none, I renew my motion to have the A3 amendment pass and be incorporated in your bill. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd like to make a motion to lay the bill over, and I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Very well. Motion has been made. To have House File 1476 be laid over. All in favor of that, and we need a roll call. Would you take the roll, please?
Representative Gunther.
No.
Representative Clark.
Yes.
Representative Dill.
Yes.
Representative Howes.
Yes.
Representative Kiefer. Representative Leidiger.
No.
Representative Lemire.
No.
Representative Mahoney.
Yes.
Representative McFarland.
No.
Representative Moline.
Yes.
Representative Mullery.
Yes.
Representative Murray.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Yes.
Representative Sanders.
No.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes.
Representative Stensrud.
No.
Representative Swedzinski.
No.
All motion fails 8-9. And is there any other questions we have? Representative Mowry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to, wherever he went, John Rakowski said he thought that the certified payroll was at the departments, and he is correct. That was part of my bill back in 2007 for enforcement, so he's correct on that. Just question, it seems from your bill, Representative Scott, that a contractor could even require, under your bill, 2 20-hour days. Is there anything in the law, then, that would be contrary to that?
In this bill, it doesn't speak to that, but I would wager to say that most contractors would not require that because they know the quality of the work would go down after a certain point.
Well, I was just... Representative Mowry, I think that Department of Transportation has a few rules against that. Driving over heavy equipment past so many hours is illegal.
Well, Mr. Chair, that would only apply to certain parts of the highway.
Oh, okay. Which parts?
And I'm not sure that that applies to construction areas.
Representative Mowry.
Second question. Since Mr. Rakowski was a deed, I think you were the one I might have asked a few years ago. I know at one time somebody from deed told me that in their inclusion of the mean average, if I go and work as a carpenter on my neighbor's fence some evenings for minimum wage, that's included as part of the average. I know they told me that a few years ago. I assume that hasn't changed since, has it?
Representative Rakowski, I mean not representative. Demeaning you like that.
Give me my page.
Mr. Rakowski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I've been gone from deed for 5 years, and you're referring to the annual survey they do, the OES data, so-called OES data. That's a survey of employers, so I don't see your scenario where a handyman going over to his neighbors would be swept into that survey. I frankly don't have the answer, though.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rakowski, I'm back on the fiscal note, and this comes from your agency. Your agency is saying that there's, I'm not seeing any savings with this particular note, this fiscal note, and you sent it to the Department of Revenue. Can you tell me why you don't, the Department of Revenue, or MMB, whichever one does the fiscal notes, came back to the labor and industry with no savings on this bill at all? Because the proponents have time and time again said that this would save 7-10%. So if we do $1 billion in construction every year, you would think there'd be $100 million or at least $70 million worth of savings. And $70 million worth of savings is not hard to find. I mean, it would be hard to miss, I'll put it that way. Why didn't they come up with it if they explained it to you?
Representative Scott.
No, that was
Representative Mahoney. The signature here is our executive budget officer who works closely with our finance people. The fiscal impact of this bill right here is to the Department of Labor and Industry only. We are not a contracting agency. So to Representative Howe's point a while ago, all the contracting agencies that are required to maintain payroll records on prevailing wage projects would need to do their own fiscal impact statement based on the recalculation from the mode to the mean.
So, Mr. Chair.
Jim Hooney.
I think you have your request for a series of fiscal notes for ways and means, because that will tell you if there's a savings or not a savings.
And you work on that.
You know. Mr. Chair. Again, because this is a relatively contentious or well-attended committee, I would like to request a roll call on this particular bill.
Absolutely. I anticipated that. Representative Sanders, you have a question? Okay. No one seeing you.
Mr. Chair, I just...
I thought you were quite...
I just want to ask the author a quick question here. I'm just trying to, given Representative Scott, the testimony and legislative auditor's statement that there's no clear answer on whether this changes construction costs, or and there's no clear answer on whether this alters construction quality, and Representative Howe's question about whether this would save the state any money. Why? I'm just curious, why are we doing this?
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I believe this, the proof will be in the pudding in this, and I really believe that this will save the state money, and it will stretch our dollars further, and it will also allow, it will also increase the number of construction companies that will report into the system, so we do get a more accurate basis for the numbers that we base prevailing wage upon.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Scott, at the beginning of your testimony, you also said that you thought this would get more workers off the bench and employed. So just trying to understand the economics here. I mean, if you just said to all these workers who are sitting in the audience here, maybe they should just get paid minimum wage, wouldn't that even increase jobs in a more significant way?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar. This is not doing away with prevailing wage. This is just changing the way that we've figured and calculated.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me just say that I know it's with late and everyone wants to go home here, but, you know, the legislative auditor talked about value judgments. I think it's important when we think about values here in the state of Minnesota. We keep divesting in our state. We're cutting government, and now we're making the claim that we should reduce wages, and somehow this is helping our economy in times of recession. I don't know how cutting wages helps our economy. That's essentially what you're doing, Representative Scott. I don't get it, and I would hope that the committee would vote no on House File.
Representative 1476. I'm going to make some closing comments. And Representative Scott, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Paymar said it correctly. This is anywhere from a 7 to a 20% pay cut for construction workers. Again, I'm going to repeat that. A 7 to 20% pay cut for construction workers in this state with this bill. And what I don't understand, well, I just want to go into that. And it's been said that there'll be no effect. There's been no immediate effect. And that the key word there is immediate. Because this likely won't have any effect this year, or maybe even next year, because there's contracts between employers and employees for 2 years.
As amended.
But if you go to prevailing wage states that have weakened their prevailing wage rates, 2 years out, you can document the wages that have gone down across the board. So members, this is a pay cut to the construction industry, not just to union, but to the non-union also. So this is a pay cut across the board to the thousands, and I think it's hundreds of thousands of construction workers in the state of Minnesota with this bill. And you know what? All those contractors that said it's so tight, we would never overcharge anybody. You know, I want you to know, this is the best story I have on this one, of the contractor that drove up complaining about, you know, we really have to keep this contract settlement to less than $1 this year, $1 next year, because we're not making any money. And happened to drive up in about $120,000 BMW. So, you know, I have never met a contractor in my life that says they're making money. Never. And I have run across ones that run multi-million dollar contract organizations to ones that run a two-man shop. This is a pay cut, and the contractors will profit from this. I'm going to vote no.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I sense that we're getting closer to a vote.
I thought we were going for it.
I was wondering how many members, if the chair could poll here, because I don't know the answer to this question, how many members of this committee serve as fiscal chairs? I know you do.
No. Previously. You mean now, this year?
At this time.
Yeah.
So that would be you, Representative Gunther, right?
And Representative House.
So, Mr. Chairman, I can't believe, I sense that this bill is going to pass out of this committee. But I just can't believe that with two fiscal chairs on this committee, that we would send a bill out without knowing the fiscal implications and do it with any kind of conscience. And I know, you know, you are a friend and honorable person, but we don't have control of what Ways and Means or any other committee, whether it be capital investment or anything, but we do have control of our actions in this committee. And I know that that this isn't right to do that. Now, if we had, without the amendment, I wouldn't have said this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still take some exception to some of the items in the fiscal note, but it is what it is. But now this bill has been amended, and now it has fiscal implications that I don't, at least as a member, and I doubt that many others do, know exactly what this means. In fact, Mr. Rutkowski testified that he couldn't quantify it. But yet we are going to pass the bill out of the committee and wash our hands of this, get the blood off of our hands until we get to the House floor, because that'll be the next time we get to visit this. And that deeply distresses me as a part of the process. And you and I generally aren't at odds a lot of times, but this we are at odds on.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Leidinger, you...
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. I just want to figure out, Mr. Mahoney, where'd you come up with, Representative Mahoney, where'd you come up with the 7% to 20% pay decrease?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
The study cited by Mr. Rimes from the ABC said a 7% to 10% savings. And labor costs are only 45% of construction costs. So you would have to double that in order to get to the kind of savings that they're talking about. So I said it was either way from 7 all the way up to 10 if they're doubling it, up to 20 if they're doubling it.
Okay.
Peggy, would you like to make some closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members and everyone that testified today. I think we've had a really, really good, meaningful discussion. And again, I just want to reiterate that this bill is about getting more of Minnesota's construction workers back to work. Nationally, 20%, excuse me, I have...
We have to give people the courtesy that we've given you. So I would appreciate no comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nationally, 20% of the construction workers are sitting on the bench and waiting for work. This bill will make our state tax dollars, our state dollars go further, allowing more projects to be built with the hard work of idle construction workers. If you consider alone the 2010 bonding bill, according to the Democrat numbers, created 21,000 jobs. If we were to save even 5% by making these changes, 1,000 more jobs would have been created. To those on the bench, I believe that would be welcome news. This bill is reasonable, and it allows for flexibility. And I'm more than willing, as stated before, to continue our dialogue with the union representation so that we can get more Minnesotans back to work. Thank you again, members.
Thank you. Now, with that, I would like to have House File 1476 pass without recommendation and go to Ways and Means as amended. And with that, we have a roll call.
Sorry.
Representative Gunther?
Yes.
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Dill?
No.
Representative Howes?
No.
Representative Kiefer?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Lemire?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Yes.
Representative Moline?
No.
Representative Mullery?
No.
Representative Murray?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Stensrud?
Yes.
Representative Swedzinski?
Yes.
Motion passes 9-8. And with that, thank you for your courtesy and thank you for your information. Meeting is adjourned.